Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 323. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
A happy James Jones.
Yeah, me too. And John Lindemann.
The one, the only.
Yeah, baby. So Guillaume is not here. His power is out up in Montreal, and he might show up a little bit later in the recording. We're not sure. I certainly do wish him the best, and if he doesn't make it for this part of the show, I
if he doesn't make it in general.
I hope you'll understand. Yeah, he might be a popsicle by the time we do the live retroactive. But anyway, just to explain the format for this week's episode, by the time you hear this, we should have already done the live retroactive. And so this segment that we're recording in advance of that is really just kind of an introduction. We wanted to cover the Nintendo Direct news that just came out this week, maybe talk about a little bit of new business, probably not a full round of it. And then just wanted that to be kind of the setup. And then in the second part of the podcast that you're listening to now, we should have a recording of the live retroactive on Majora's Mask, which as of this moment when we're recording this part hasn't happened yet.
But it is hopefully a pre-retro retroactive.
Yeah. It's a little weird for us, but for you, it'll sound pretty normal and pretty easy to follow. And if you were a part of that live retroactive, I thank you in advance / in retrospect. And I hope you enjoy it. For everyone who hasn't heard it yet, I hope it is really good. So anyway. Hopefully we'll get Guillaume on a little bit later, but I feel pretty confident that he will be on the retroactive part of it.
I hope the power's still not out then.
Yeah, really. That would be very, very bad.
For those of you who don't understand, it's really damn cold in North America right now, or at least huge swaths of it.
Really, really cold, yeah.
Like historic colds kind of stuff. He's in fucking Canada.
He texted me earlier and said it was minus 25 Celsius in Montreal. And I think it's a little bit warmer than that now, but you can imagine what that's like when the power goes out and it's that cold. So hopefully he's safe and sound, and you'll hear from him a little bit later one way or the other. But before we get kicked off on the crazy Nintendo Direct discussion, also wanted to mention that we just got confirmation earlier this week that we will be returning to the Penny Arcade Expo East in Boston, Massachusetts on March 23rd for the fourth annual RFN live panel. The panel is called, excuse me, I'm very proud of this name, Super Radio Free Nintendo 64 Live Panel, You and Me.
And that name never happened, thank God.
Yeah. No, that will be printed on the poster. I'm going to take a photo just to prove that really is the name of the panel. And we don't really know what we're going to do for it yet. I'd like to make it maybe just a little bit different than, you know, just freshen it up and maybe do something slightly different than we've done in the past.
I have one suggestion, and John and I talked about this one time before.
Oh, dear. Spring it on me. Just right here on the show. Go ahead.
Black tie formal.
Hey, I'm down.
You know, I kind of like that.
There we go.
I kind of do like that. Anyway, tickets are unfortunately already sold out. Saturday is always the first day to go because it's the biggest, you know, weekend day of the convention. So I hope that you already have tickets. If not, sucks, but, we will record the panel, just like we always have, and we'll make it a podcast episode so that everybody can participate in some way. And we might even try to do some kind of live stream for those who can't make it to PAX East. But also wanted to mention that the Connectivity Podcast also are going to be returning for the second year of their panel. Last year they did Nintendo-themed Jeopardy, and this year they're doing Who Wants to Be a Nintendo-Ware as a live panel, and I'm sure they'll have prizes. It's going to be really fun, and that's on Sunday, March 24th, also at 11 a.m., and that day, as of this recording at least, there are still tickets available. So if you live near Boston or you're willing to travel just for one day of the show, go ahead and pick those up. I'm sure they will sell out very, very soon. So you really don't want to delay. But I'm sure they're going to record that and podcast that as well. So everybody will get to enjoy it in some sense. And also wanted to mention that sort of in celebration, it was really in anticipation of returning to PAX East, I went to our t-shirt store, which hasn't seen a whole lot of action in the past few months, and I cut the prices on everything. So our t-shirt provider, this company called Spreadshirt that sort of runs the store for us, they increased the prices on all their products a little bit because of, you know, increased shirt costs and stuff like that. So all the prices had gone up without us really having anything to do about it. And so I went in there and cut our commission on everything by even more. So there's even still like a net price reduction on everything in there. So we've got two or three
everything
different...
Everything must go!
No, it's they print them on order. So it really there
everything
is...
Everything must be printed to order.
Yeah. It's not like every, it's not like we have a stock that we're trying to get rid of. I'm just trying to juice sales, man.
Hey, so am I, man. Listen to this voice. This is magic.
No, John, golden. John, to be fair, if you're trying to sell, everything must go. It's on sale now! It's Radio Free Nintendo store.
So we actually have two or three different designs for a Radio Free Nintendo t-shirt, and there's some long sleeve, there's a ringer that looks really nice, and there's also a couple designs of the connectivity shirt. So lots of choices. There's the really nice shirts. I've got a couple myself. I'm going to be ordering some extras, and I hope you will go check them out and consider doing it, because all the sales of the t-shirts do support our podcast and our website. And they're also really very helpful in promotion for the panel and for the podcast if you happen to wear them at something like PAX East. So that's all the shilling out of the way. And now we're going to get into the real juicy stuff, because this morning we had a Nintendo Direct. It's not a terribly special event. They happen every couple of months.
Oh, but it was.
But this one was more special than most, I'll say. We had been warned, of course, like 24 hours in advance that it was going to focus on Wii U and that it was going to contain some new game announcements for Wii U. And I think if you look at the sales of the system, although they've been okay around the world, they haven't really been lighting things up like Nintendo had forecast. And it does look like Nintendo's probably going to miss their sales targets for the fiscal year, which you'll hear more about this in late March once the fiscal year ends and they have to do their sort of investor reports. But they're probably going to come in a couple million units short on the hardware sales that they had originally predicted for the system. And with lackluster third-party support, to say the least, and you know, a lot of their first-party games have been delayed and pushed back later in the year, I think they really felt the need to get out there and say, look, we can't just like start dropping games on your head right away because they take time to make, but we want to at least announce some things that will get you excited and will make people consider buying a Wii U, even if there's not a ton of stuff out right now that you want to play. I think they're hoping to get people to make sort of anticipatory purchases on the system so that they'll be ready when the really hot games start to drop. So first up, with Iwata on the Nintendo Direct talked about the Wii U Virtual Console, which this was heavily predicted and a lot of people really wanted to hear about it. We found out, you know, they're adding GBA. They're gonna sort of re-add all the Wii Virtual Console games to the eShop on Wii U, and they're gonna add, you know, the ability to play on the gamepad and Miiverse support. And if you just buy the games for the first time, then you'll get all that stuff for the same price you would have paid on Wii. If you already have it on your Wii account that you moved over to your Wii U, then you can upgrade to the Wii U version for $1 or $1.50.
Depending on the system.
And I'm very curious to, yeah, depending on what system it was out for. And I'm very curious to hear what you guys think of this plan.
I think it's kind of cheeseball, to be honest with you. I would like to see Nintendo extend an olive branch to its most ardent fans.
It did. It extended the olive branch up your butt. to be fair, I was calling for them to just totally stiff everybody. So, I mean, people had suggested a possible cheap upgrade if you had the original. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see if they're going to just one day say, it's all there, and all the games are suddenly available. Or if it's going to be like this slow bleed.
Well, the way he described it, I mean, he did say that, you know, look, we can't get all of these games up on the eShop all at the same time. It's going to take a while. It's probably going to go in phases. And my thought was, you know, they could try to trickle these out one or two a week, just like they did the first time around.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. That's what I don't want.
More likely, I think, is that they have working emulators. And I do think a lot of games have sort of you know, I think we know that on Virtual Console on Wii, every game ships with its own emulator. But I think in a lot of cases, those emulators are the same across many titles, and they just tweak them a little bit for certain games that have special features that just have weird qualities to them. And I feel like probably, let's say for NES games, there are 10 different versions of the emulator, and those 10 versions cover all the NES games that are out on Wii Virtual Console. I think they will probably work on those emulators one at a time and upgrading them to the Wii U version. And as they do that, each time they get a new version of it, that's going to carry with it 20 or 30 games, right? And so I don't think it's going to be like a trickle like it was in the first place when they were trying to get the rights and get all the ESRB stuff and, you know, test the emulators in the first place. I think in this case, they're probably emulating the emulator that is emulating the ROM. And so they don't have to do it title by title.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I would hope that, I mean, obviously, like, I understand that there is cost involved with porting these over to Wii U and making them playable on the gamepad. So I can understand that. I would hope that over time, as they, you know, kind of get the code sorted out and all that, that they would actually be able to lower the cost. So maybe this $1 cost goes away at some point, although I can't really see that happening.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to charge it up front and then take it away.
But, yeah.
You know, this is a weird compromise because you could be really pessimistic and say, well, they're just going to make us pay full price for them all over again. If you want it on the Wii U, you're going to have to pay $8 for, you know, Super Mario World. And in that case, you know, if that's what you were expecting, then yeah, being able to pay only $1.50 to upgrade to the Wii U version so you can play it on the gamepad and use the Miiverse and, you know, save states and reconfigurable gamepad controls and everything, for $1.50 is a lot better than paying $8 for it.
Yeah.
And I do firmly believe that Nintendo doesn't owe it to us to give us this upgrade for free. I think you paid for the game to play it on Wii, and you still can. And in fact, they've added backwards compatibility, so you can even play these Wii Virtual Console games on your Wii U just in the Wii mode, which is not, they didn't even have to do that. So I don't think that they owe us anything, but I think it would have been smart. I think it would have been a lot smarter than what we do have here for them to say, if you've already bought a lot of Virtual Console stuff on Wii, mm-hmm. you're going to get the upgraded version for free as a gift to us, because then, especially with the Miiverse integration, then we become the ambassadors of the word of mouth to convince all those other people to buy the new Wii U version. And those people fund the work that it takes to actually get this stuff running on Wii U.
Yeah. Now, what I think would have been better was if they would have said, we'll do exactly that, what you just described, until a certain date. And then after that, if you want to upgrade, you know, you'll have to pay.
Yeah, that would have been good. Yeah. Or I think Carl Castaneda posted this on Twitter today, but if it had just been like a one-time $10 fee.
Yeah.
It's like, look, yes, it does cost us something, but how about this? The more games that you bought on Wii Virtual Console, the better deal this is for you, because mm-hmm. you're splitting this fee up among that many more games that are going to now be compatible with Wii U. Because I have about 75 Virtual Console games.
Yeah,
and I would be more than happy to spend $10 just as a one-time blanket fee. And then they're not all going to be available at once, but as they become available, I will then be able to play them. Mm-hmm. And instead, it's going to take who knows how long for this to do it, and they're going to ask me to pay $1 or $1.50 every single time. I might do that for like 5 games out of the 60, 75 that I own, which tells me that they're really not doing this well, because they're not even going to get the $10 that they could have had if they charged a lump sum. They're going to be lucky to get $5 or $6 out of this whole deal. Because I'm not going to pay for all those over again.
Here's kind of how I look at it if I'm Nintendo. I understand why they are doing it, you know, on an ad hoc. But I think in their mind, they've done you more than a justice at this point. So they're just like, whatever. I think they're really looking at this more of as just a dead restart to the Virtual Console. That's what I'm worried about. But that's what I think they're doing. So I think they basically say, all right, we're starting over again. And if you want to get on board with the new start, that's fine. But it's going to cost you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, it's not a dead restart, because they're starting with the catalog that's already available. They're working on getting all those.
But they're not starting with the Wii U catalog that's already available. They're starting with the catalog that's already available if you go to the Wii channel.
That's the starting point, and then they're going to add to that. They've already said they're going to add GBA stuff, which I'm like, really? I mean, I'd rather have that stuff on 3DS, and I think this does bode well for them also doing it on 3DS.
Which I don't know.
They didn't mention 3DS the whole Nintendo Direct.
Well, no, this was a Wii U Nintendo Direct.
Yeah.
It was,
So they haven't excluded that, certainly. But in terms of, there probably aren't many GBA games I would want to have on Wii U, but I can see the appeal of playing those games on the gamepad, because then it's kind of like you're holding the GBA XXXXL.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yep.
Like this giant
GBA XXXL.
And it has that widescreen, which, you know, you didn't really have back with the Game Boy Player. And I can see that, like, for a very few number of games, that would actually be kind of cool to have it on this huge handheld screen. But for the most part, I'd rather have those games on 3DS Virtual Console. And I think that probably will happen at some point.
Mega Man Zero, all of them, bring to me.
But certainly, you know, I am happy that they're talking about Virtual Console, that they spent so much time on it, that they are doing something about it, they're moving forward with it. And I think, you know, mainly they're doing it to sort of satisfy the gamers who have already bought the system and don't have very much to play on it in the next few months. And I think this is meant to kind of fill in those gaps and give you something to feel good about and something to occupy you until Pikmin 3 and all this other stuff comes out later in the year. But it does give me hope that they are actually maybe going to, you know, catch back up to where the Wii was with Virtual Console and then move forward with it and start adding those extra Super Nintendo games that they never got around to, and the extra N64 games that they never got around to.
That goes back to my point that I said at the very beginning, though, and it's a question of, is this going to be a trickle, or is this going to be like, all right, here's all the games. I mean, maybe not in one shot, but like over the course of a few months, or is it going to be like over the course of a few years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it's over the course of a few years, they're viewing the Wii, in my mind, they've decided the Wii Virtual Console and the Wii U Virtual Console are distinct entities, and they're just doing this as a favor.
Mm-hmm.
If they do them all in one shot, they're viewing one as an evolution of the other. But if they're going to trickle them out, in their mind, it's obviously two very distinct things.
Hmm.
And they're viewing this as a complete reboot of the whole world. I will say, though, as a person who doesn't own a ton of Virtual Console games, maybe 10, it's not a huge pain point, because I'm probably only going to pay to move over 3.
Yeah.
Ogre Battle, Majora's Mask, and Lords of Thunder.
Lords of Thunder.
Now, James, do you feel like there are maybe games that you didn't buy the first time around that you might be more tempted to buy now that they're going to be on the new platform with these new features?
I think I'll be more tempted because the shopping experience is easier. That was one of the biggest reasons I don't have a lot of Virtual Console games. It was such a pain in the ass to buy anything.
Mm-hmm.
I can't argue with you.
Yeah.
it's the eShop is far superior, that's for sure. We also found out that we're going to have a couple system updates to make the whole system faster, which...
Well, the transitions, really. So one makes things faster to load, one makes things faster to get back to the home menu.
Well, I don't know that those are going to be separate. I think they may just kind of do... I think it's going to be a little bit faster with the next update, and the second update it's going to be a little bit more faster. I don't know that they're doing the into and out of separately.
It kind of sounded like they were, though.
It was worded strangely, but that's what happens when you have a Japanese man, you know, talking in English for 20 minutes on your press release, your video press release. There were a couple of moments like that where it was really not terribly clear what they were getting at, but I think this is much needed. And, you know, I just realized last night, as I had to temporarily delete Assassin's Creed 3 to make room to, to download the cave and probably the Zombie U demo as well. The operating system on Wii U takes up 5 gigabytes of your internal memory.
Of
5 gigabytes.
Of the 32?
Of the if you buy the normal one, that's of the 8.
Wow.
Of the 8 gigabytes in the basic system, the OS takes up more than half.
It's a known quantity. I mean, they have said it.
Oh, I know. I didn't realize that until last night. It's like, you look at this, and what are you doing with this space? I mean, no wonder that it takes so long to move around, because you're shifting entire gigabytes of data just to switch menus. It's clearly just a bloated mess. And I bet you, as the system updates come that make the whole thing faster, I bet you that footprint gets smaller over the years. I really do. Because that is absolutely ridiculous. That's bigger than Windows 8. easily bigger than Windows 8. And it's what much slower too. Anyway, that just kind of blew my mind when I finally
It doesn't have live tiles though, to be fair. So when we get live tiles in, on VU, that's when we'll reach the mountain. We have icons with Miis running around them.
We have dead tiles on Wii U. I kind of prefer them that way.
I want to know. Actually, we do kind of have some of the live tile stuff, people talking around icons, but that's a whole interface discussion that I don't think anybody on the show wants to talk about.
Nope. So let's move on to a much bigger, much more important announcement, in my opinion. I'm skipping all the way to the end of the Nintendo Direct here because I felt like it was pretty disappointing up to this point, and we'll talk about why a little bit later. But they ended with a giant announcement for Monolith's follow-up to Xenoblade. They showed about a minute and a half trailer for this, had music, it showed actual gameplay, not just CG or
It showed or, amazing or looking gameplay.
Yeah. The gameplay looked really fantastic, impressive. And it really does look like a Xenoblade sequel or some kind of, at least, you know, kind of spiritual successor to Xenoblade. But the menu system, I mean the display on the screen, the interface, looks like a shinier version of Xenoblade.
Yeah, it was less cartoony, more techy looking.
Mm-hmm. A little, but, yes. There are transforming vehicles. You can have a mech
giant robot mechs. Yes,
that transforms into a bike,
give
like some kind
to
of
me.
Jet bike.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like up to that point, it was like I was kind of like, okay, well this is sort of cool. Yep, you know, it's HD. You know,
the bits they showed these huge monsters that were just absurd. I mean, they make stuff in Xenoblade look stupid.
And all the landscapes.
Yeah, and that was really cool, but it's kind of what I would expect as part of an upgrade. And then I saw the guy hopping in the mech, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Shit just got – and then he went to town on a monster.
Yeah, they definitely took it to the next level there. But up till then, they were showing all the things you would want from Xenoblade, the giant landscapes, the mountain ranges in the background, you know, the gorgeous lakes and rivers that you're walking alongside, and the huge monsters off in the distance that you know you can walk right up to them. And it really did look – they didn't call it Xenoblade 2, but I think ultimately that's what this is. I think
so
it is
it's got a pretty
direct follow-up to Xenoblade.
They ended it with the big Xenogears Red X, which could tie the mecha stuff in better. Yeah. But there are mecha in Xenoblade. You just don't get to use them.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole planet that
well,
is
no,
a
I mean,
mech.
there are human-controlled mecha.
Yeah.
At the very beginning of the game, one of the characters gets inside one.
Yes.
And then gets their shit wrecked. But they get in one. It's nothing as sleek as this one, though.
Without spoiling the story, that stuff there, that theme continues throughout the game as well. So, I felt that this was a pretty obvious way for the series to go, but it looked fantastic.
The combat looked a little bit more action-y, though.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah, some of the weapons were
machine guns and stuff,
machine gun based, but they're also like lightning swords and the kind of crazy stuff that's already.
And the fact too, they had you flying around that boss and the mech shooting at it.
Oh, just cutting appendages off.
I was just like, what? That's crazy.
He
slashed awesome.
An appendage off the thing.
Yeah.
And it did like 8,000 damage. It was amazing. It was just stunning.
Yeah.
And of course, every name in that game is the people from its predecessor. In the trailer, they just list names. Sano's on the music. I'm blanking on the character designer. But
Takano.
I mean, it's. Yeah, it's the Xenoblade team to an extent.
Or the Xenogears team, if you will, James.
It's true, actually. It might be.
The red X at the end?
The red Xenogears X is at the end of the trailer.
Yeah. Have any of us played Xenogears?
I've played a little bit of it, but not much.
I always wanted to, but then I started to hear a lot of backlash after it came out.
Well, it won't surprise you, but I actually do have a copy of it, but I've never opened it.
It's probably worth a shitload of money.
It is.
Dude.
It's worth about $150, I think. So,
oh my god.
Yeah, it's worth a lot of money.
It's supposed to be a good game.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
But what's amazing to me about that trailer is it looks pretty far along.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, we don't know if maybe that's all they've built of the game or the areas they showed us in the trailer. Could be.
Yeah, but I mean, to get to that point, I mean, they would have to have
there's
a
already
lot of
an
stuff
engine.
Built.
Yeah, there's already an engine. There's already combat system built.
Yep.
Seems to be online multiplayer because – and I think there's definitely multiplayer in the game. But there's also one of the scenes you can see a running chat log on the left side of the screen of people chatting. Now, that could be some kind of really fancy Miiverse integration that just looks – that fits the look of the game so it doesn't look all cartoony like Miiverse. But they've made it kind of conform to the art style. But more likely, that looks like a sort of, you know, Phantasy Star or Monster Hunter style chat log of people typing on their computers or doing, you know, something like that as they play through the game.
I was trying to read it, but it's A, my Japanese is not good, and B, it was just too blurry in the video I was watching.
Yeah.
So I'll sit down with it a little bit later and get the high res off the Nintendo press site and try to read it.
Well, it wouldn't be local multiplayer if there's a text chat log on the screen.
So one thing that I did see moving along, though, was like status statements. Like in Xenoblade, they just keep giving you these alerts. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought maybe that was just alerts pouring through, but it's going a little bit too fast. So I'm not sure. Somebody needs to just sit down and read the stupid thing and see what's going on.
I think it's an online chat console, which it could be a single player game that just has online chat, mm-hmm. but more
or,
than
or
likely
it could be a single player game that has online modes. I mean, would you be surprised at all if they said you can take your characters and go Monster Hunter style? I mean, this
I would not be surprised.
This is a Japanese
at all.
Game, and it's about slaying big ass monsters.
And mm-hmm. Xenoblade already has some similarities to Monster Hunter. It's in some ways it is a more RPG style version of Monster Hunter. That because it's not an action game, it doesn't have the control issues that Monster Hunter does, and so it's
it doesn't have the goofy running either.
Much less frustrating.
I couldn't watch this live, and I couldn't watch it during the day. All I had was Twitter going and me frantically trying to steal time to watch it on my cell phone. I finally found a quiet spot, watched it on my cell phone, and then sat there and just watched it like six more times.
Yeah, I've seen it a few times myself. The trailer is really spectacular, and I think the most exciting thing for me, even though I expected a game in this vein to be announced maybe around E3 or maybe later in the year, I definitely wasn't expecting to hear about it this early in 2013. And after all the cock teases that preceded it in this Nintendo Direct, all the talk about games that they weren't actually ready to show yet, for them to bust this out of nowhere and show an actual video with real gameplay that looked this amazing, that was the moment where I said, oh God, I'm so glad I got up early to watch this.
Mm-hmm. So here's the question. I mean, that's, in terms of a console game, that's like top tier of stuff, of visually, of stuff I've seen.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of games that are in that.
I mean, it's right up there with anything out of Square Enix.
Look at Xenoblade and how good it looks on Wii, and then you give them the power of an HD console. You can't really be surprised that it looks that
good. Do you think this game being in development, because obviously it was in development, I would guess, in 2011.
I mean, they moved on to it, I'm sure, as soon as they got done.
Xenoblade was released in the summer of 2010 in Japan.
Do you think this game coming along in development contributed to Xenoblade actually coming out in the West?
Oh, that's interesting. It might have been a factor, yeah.
I think it did. I think NOE and NCL had a really early build of this game, showed it to their representatives in Europe and North America, and NOE's like...
Well, I mean, I think they probably went hand in hand. I mean, they kind of saw the buzz that it was getting, and...
Yeah, and then they saw what was coming behind it, and they said...
Yeah.
John, I wonder if it's even more than that. I wonder if this game was sort of in, you know, like pre-planning, you know, like kind of just on paper, maybe some concept art. And then when it did release in Europe and it got those crazy reviews and it sold surprisingly well, then they kind of got the approval to go into full bore development and really push forward with it.
Yep.
And then when it eventually came out in America too, and it actually sold, I think, maybe even better in America than it did in Europe, and certainly both did better than in Japan, where it was kind of a bomb. Yeah. I think maybe at that point they really committed to it and said, okay, we're definitely going to push forward hard with this game. And the fact that they showed it in America and in the American Nintendo Direct on the same day that they revealed it in Japan, that says a lot. I mean, it really does. I know Xenoblade was actually shown in America before anywhere else when it was Monado.
Monado.
And it was that weird E3 trailer about 4 or 5 years ago.
Best name ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was that was one of those cases where there's a video at Nintendo's booth and none of the employees know what the hell it is.
Mm-hmm. No, or in my first E3's case, a controller that no one knows what it's in, the plastic dome.
Well, I mean, it could very well be that. I mean, I'm not too sure how big their team is, whether or not they would.
I mean, they're a decent sized company, but they have a 3DS project in the works too.
Yeah,
so.
Well, because I mean, where I'm going with it is, I don't know if they would have spun off a separate team to kind of work on pitching the next Nintendo console game. at the end. I mean, it could very well be they finished up with Chronicles and then moved right on to working. So by the time they got the Wii U one greenlit, things may have already gotten picked up in Europe, and you know what I mean? So I mean, by that time, we're talking about it gaining steam. That could very well be what happened.
I would be surprised at all if the senior planning team and some of the artists and stuff had spun out in the last, handful of iterations going through Chronicles and just started doing planning work for the next game.
Yeah.
So when they finished up Chronicles, they'd be there ready to say, next project's up, let's get to work.
Think about that. For those of us in America, the three of us guys at least, and a lot of the people listening to this podcast, it took 5 years for the Wii to get a game like this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're looking at maybe getting this game in the first 2 years of Wii U. That is really exciting.
And there were some other announcements in this Nintendo Direct that are really good. But this was their drop the mic moment, as it were.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And this shit. Boom. So, we out.
Yeah, so this was the real high point, and that's why I wanted to focus the most time on it, because otherwise Chris Kohler wrote about this today and referred to all this stuff as vaporware, and I don't know if I agree with that use of the term, although he works at Wired, and they are kind of the experts on vaporware, but, Nintendo spent a lot of time talking about, we're working on a new Zelda game. They talked about the Wind Waker HD remake. Didn't even show video from that. It's a remake, and it's coming out this fall. And they didn't even show a video trailer for it. They showed basically some screenshots.
Yeah.
And what they showed is weird. I'm not sure if it's target renders or what. I mean, it just doesn't look like a game. I mean, it could be that it
doesn't look in engine. It looks more like concept art, or like you said, target render is probably the best word for it.
Mm-hmm. It's a very I mean, if that's what the game looks like when it comes out, I don't know if I'm going to like it or not. I mean, the characters looked kind of weird.
Yeah.
It looked kind of Play-Doh-y.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, I mean, I'm excited about it because Wind Waker is my favorite Zelda game.
Yeah. But a whole lot of the stuff kind of fell in the, we kind of figured that was coming out anyways. But,
there's a new 3D Mario coming. We know there's a new Mario Kart coming. We know. Why don't you show it?
Yeah.
Hey. And the new 3D Mario coming, though, the fact that it'll be at E3 and playable tells us
it's good news,
because
that's maybe happening a little earlier than I would expect. Yeah. So that's good.
Yep. Certainly happening earlier than Guillaume would expect. Guillaume. Not here to defend yourself and your busted ass.
I mean, I would have expected that maybe in the fall sometime. You know,
just to be
game show maybe
for the first time.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So that's good news. But I mean, stuff like, hey, remember that Smash Brothers game we announced 2 years ago? We're gonna have screenshots at
E3. I laughed so hard.
That's a pretty funny announcement.
I was like,
really?
That is the ultimate FU. That game is not coming along well.
Yeah,
I think the word he used was images, and I think that might end up translating into a trailer. I don't think they're quite so crass as to literally show screenshots at a press conference.
Hey guys, this game that we hinted at 2 years ago at E3, we're going to put out a press release about it at E3.
Please look forward to it.
What kind of an announcement is that? We're going to have screenshots. What would you fucking do?
Johnny, you and I are going to be dragged into a room at night, or at, say, 7 p.m. at night one night, and they're going to show us target renders of Smash Brothers.
I think there will be an actual trailer. And they'll talk about it. You know, they'll reveal more details. But I don't think they're going to get away with showing screenshots at E3 for
Who's
Smash
gonna stop
Brothers.
Them?
All right, here's two screenshots. Get out. Every single one of you, get out. You see too much.
Even better if they were two screenshots of, the menus.
Yeah.
The boot screen.
Just to get back to Zelda real quick, Eiji Aonuma showed up and very briefly talked about their progress on the new Zelda for Wii U, and didn't show it, said they weren't ready to show it because they didn't know what it was going to look like yet. This seems to be his MO, is they develop the graphics last for their Zelda
games.
That's
right. The game's really almost done. We just need to build an entirely new graphics engine.
Yeah. Really, really weird way of doing development.
Super close.
But he did kind of throw up a little PowerPoint and said basically they're rethinking the conventions of Zelda. And they're reconsidering certain aspects, like having to play the dungeons in a certain order and having to play alone.
That was the one that was interesting to me.
Well, mm-hmm. I feel like, I'm very glad to hear that they're rethinking the conventions of Zelda, But what he's talking about has been done before. I mean, playing the dungeons in any order you can do in Zelda 1 and Zelda 2, and to some extent you can play the dungeons out of order even in A Link to the Past. And so that's not, I mean, it's going back to the roots, which is great, but it's not really a new idea in Zelda. And then playing Zelda as a multiplayer game has been done at least twice that I know of. Actually, at least three or four times if you include the DS games in their mode. So those aren't full-on cooperative adventures, and maybe that's the, you know, maybe they're going in that direction.
And they've always been that top-down 2D stuff as well. So, I mean, if we're talking like a fully in like embraced 3D world, I mean, that kind of goes to what we were talking about a couple weeks ago. I mean, it depends on how they implement it, but if there are multiple characters on screen acting independent of one another, that is... in a full 3D Zelda, that is a step in a new direction.
Yeah, or... especially if they're not different, all different colored Links.
Yeah. Well, I mean, go look at, because even in like Wind Waker, where you constantly have NPC partners in the dungeons, mm-hmm. they mostly just stand the fuck around.
Yeah. I mean, it could very well be that they're going to have optional group content, maybe, where you could, you know, somebody could pick a particular character, and
I'm Marth.
You can go off and, you know, do whatever and maybe complete optional group quests for extra stuff. You know, that's the thing. It's like, it'll be interesting to see how they kind of, whether or not it's shoehorned in.
So here's what I think right now. And I think this will make it difficult to conjecture if I'm right. I think they have no idea at this point. I think they have a target objective, multiplayer content. They have a target objective, alter the dungeon structure, and that's it. And they're like, all right.
They're probably just spitballing.
You know, this is a game they've been working on for at least a year. So I think they're farther along than that.
Well,
but
they may be farther along on the core game, but if the multiplayer stuff is kind of a side thing, they may still be sitting on Glenmore.
Yeah, I mean they may have put in a year's worth of work, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily far along.
Well, no, you're right. And this game might still be a long ways off.
Miyamoto has exhausted their supply of T-tails.
Yeah, I mean especially if they are reworking it that drastically, they may have had a couple of restarts.
Oh,
you know?
I guarantee you, if they are working as drastic as I said, they had at least one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty standard operating procedure, though, on the Zelda franchise. They seem to restart every game. Even the game we're talking about this weekend, Majora's Mask, started out as something. I mean, it started out as Ura Zelda, and then out of that experience of trying to make a Zelda expansion for the 64DD, they ended up reusing the engine in a very different way and made a totally new game out of it. So this is not anything new.
And you can actually play Ura Zelda or parts of it if you want.
You can. They did eventually go back and finish it after they made Majora's Mask. Yeah.
It's a weird experience.
It's not that great, I would say. But you know, I just feel like I'm always happy to hear Nintendo talk about Zelda. And especially when they're talking about refreshing it in this way, which I'm totally behind, and I'm really excited to see what they do in all of their creativity and ingenuity. But it's hard for me to get excited about games that I haven't seen yet. You know, especially games
that I know
in principle already exist. When you come out and say, hey, we're working on Mario and Zelda and Smash Brothers, I have to say back to you, yeah, I knew that already. Tell me something I don't know.
Yeah.
And they really didn't tell us anything
we
didn't
already
know.
The only thing they told us that we didn't know about the two Mario games is that they'd be playable at E3.
Yeah. Which is good. But again, it's the classic wait for E3, wait for Space World, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It is a message to the fans, but it's like the bare minimum that you could possibly say about it.
Yeah, they aren't really committing to anything.
Yeah, they couldn't just say, we're making one. Because then they'd be like, well,
I mean, again, if the whole point of this Nintendo Direct was to reinvigorate the fans and to try to convince people who haven't yet, you know, been totally sold on the idea of Wii U that this stuff is coming and you should really be excited and you should go ahead and buy one because you're going to be happy that you did. I'm not sure that talking about a Mario game that doesn't exist yet, as far as we know, and has never been shown, I don't know that that really convinces anyone. I think everybody and their mother assumes there will be a new 3D Mario game on this system at some point. So just coming out and saying that, it's really kind of pointless.
What? Or if they don't, they'll just wait till the console comes out. Or if the game comes out, rather.
Anyway, I'm not complaining about these games existing. I'm very excited to see them. But I'm no more excited to see them today than I was yesterday before the Nintendo Direct happened. It's just, this doesn't advance my knowledge whatsoever, you know?
I'm marginally more excited about these games now. You know, I was I got hype over Wind Waker HD Remake because that game is still beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The world looks a little bit different.
But again, they didn't actually show it.
No, yeah. The screenshots they released, some of the sites, they just showed Windfall Island. But some of the screenshots they released do look a little bit different from what their original world is. So I wonder if they're going to add any content or something.
Well, it's going to be in widescreen, which I think for this game in particular is going to make a difference.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to it. I'm probably going to buy it, but it's still an HD remake. I mean, you can only go so far with your enthusiasm for something like that.
I do wonder if they're going to consider finishing some of those dungeons that were half done.
Yeah, now that would really change my tune. I mean, that would really make me excited for this, to see them go back and say...
Because the town is definitely different. There's at least one building that I saw in the screenshot that doesn't exist in the original game.
Hmm.
But it's just a building. I mean, who knows? Especially if they're just target renders, and fuck, who knows?
Yeah.
But what was exciting to me was that game exists, because I've wanted it forever. I'm happy to hear they've got a new Zelda and that they're really pondering ideas. The multiplayer stuff is interesting insofar as it gives us stuff to talk about on the show in the future.
Yeah, it's a little scary also.
A little bit. Yeah. It's a little bit scary.
But I'm
really
trying
is.
To be optimistic about it.
The 3D Mario is exciting because if it's playable at E3, there's a pretty good chance it comes out this year.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah. In generally speaking, Mario games playable at E3, thumbs up. Zelda games playable at E3, probably not. It's just a rule of thumb. It seems to apply pretty well.
Zelda has to be at least two E3s.
It's two and a half. It's usually one tease, two full showings. I was excited for that one because that means my prediction was dead on. No new Zelda game this year and a new Mario 3D game from the Tokyo people. Yeah.
And of course, Greg's prediction from last year.
Let me read this because this is Bizarro Land crazy. Greg's first prediction during the 2011 going into 2012 predictions for the year of 2012, which ended 24 days ago today, the day of the announcement, was Goodfeel will produce a Yoshi game, most likely for Wii. I missed that one. That is, quote, more of a hope based on their two-year gaps of games. And later downstream, he began to refer to that game as basically Yoshi's Epic Yarn. Well, guess what?
So we don't know the official title yet, but it sure as hell looks like Yoshi's Epic Yarn.
It's Yarn Yoshi.
It looks like Yoshi's Story, really.
Yeah.
It's made of fabric. I mean, it is almost exactly the same art style as Kirby's Epic Yarn, but with Yoshi.
They're referring to it as Yarn Yoshi.
Yep. I don't like Yarn Yoshi.
Yeah.
Now, Yarnshi, I can
get
behind.
That's the name of the game now. John, that's the name of the game. Whenever anybody talks about it from here on out, Yarn Yoshi.
Yarn Yoshi.
I could do Yarnshi.
Nope. Yarn Yoshi. It sounds ridiculous enough to go. I'm happy with it. John, Super Yarn Yoshi U. Done.
Super Yarn Yoshi U-verse.
Done. I'm surprised that they're going back to the same aesthetic that they did with Kirby, but it looks really nice. And I do think Yoshi is a really interesting character that they haven't done much with in the past few years. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited to see what these guys do. And especially if you look at what they did with Kirby, they really threw out a lot of the fundamentals of that character when they made their version of him. And I'm quite curious to see how they handle Yoshi, because I think if you look back at the kinds of action that Yoshi's had in his previous platformers, I don't think you can necessarily assume that he's going to be doing the same kind of thing, you know, throwing eggs or eating fruit and stuff like that. They may go a very different direction with it.
But a lot of the stuff they had Kirby doing in Epic Yarn would fit kind of well to Yoshi, or at least some of it.
Sort of lassoing things.
Some of the yarn stuff, just replace with his tongue. Yeah.
I can see that. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know where they're going to go with it, but a 2D platformer, those guys are just so good with the graphics, and the gameplay is really tight.
Can they just buy them now and be done with it, please? Can they just drop the money and just fully own them now? I mean, just do it at this point.
Yeah. Honestly, I probably would have been more excited to see them do a Yoshi game in the style of Wario Land Shake It. Because I think that would be really interesting to see like a cartoon version of Yoshi.
But the patches and fabric, though, do sort of go back to the Yoshi 64 game. I mean, there is a lot of that kind of textury stuff.
True.
In the game. And I think that's what the callback is.
So maybe it'll be like Yoshi's Story 2.
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff in the game in the pictures looks like a hybridization of the Epic Yarn style and the Yoshi story style.
Hmm.
So I wonder if that's sort of like, all right, we'll just sort of mix the two together. Yeah. It is going to lose. It can't be about yarn, though, because they're going to lose the wee blur that made the yarn look so real.
No, they could. I mean, they could put a filter over it and.
They're going to have to actually filter it now versus before they just let the wee take care of it. Well, HD's going to screw this shit up. Let's go ahead and not even try.
But it looks really good. It really wasn't all that much of a surprise just because it's been predicted so much and talked about so much and then kind of leaked a couple different times.
Yeah.
And we were never sure if we should believe the leaks, you know, or maybe they were just kind of bugs or maybe they were just placeholder values. And
Best
anyway.
Buy Canada has all your breaking news.
Yeah, apparently so.
What the hell is going on up in Best Buy Canada right now?
Hey, there's no law out there. It's survival of the fittest.
It's like, you know? Anytime Nintendo wants to announce something, Best Buy Canada's like, no, we got this.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if they get pissed off at anybody up there, just bring it. Bring it.
McDonald's-shaped Wii's? Got it. We got this. We already broke that story.
We train bears to attack up there.
Mounted
I can vouch for it.
They,
yep.
Bears that ride horses and wear
red hats. They just put bears in Parliament and called it done.
Yeah. So to wrap up the announcements really quickly, I thought it was interesting there's no word on Retro Studios. And, you know, it could mean a couple of things for me. It could mean they're just waiting until E3 so that they don't blow, you know, they don't give away all their big surprises before E3. Or it could mean, go with me here.
Nope.
What if Retro Studios is making the new Mario Kart entirely? Like, what if Mario Kart 7 and their involvement with that game was sort of an apprenticeship and they're now taking over the Mario Kart
series?
They
just made some stages. They didn't build the physics engine or anything.
But they learned how to do it, and they worked with the original creators. And it's not what I would want them to do, but I think it's a possibility.
Here's more my guess of what happened. Every region saw the same games, and it was being made in Japan, and Japan
except Earthbound.
Except Earthbound. Japan dictated the content, and ultimately, it was focused on their Japanese developers.
True.
True. And I think that's more what it was. I think. It was Retro probably has something they could have shown, but since they were going to show all the same games to everybody except for Earthbound, they just went ahead and did it.
Hmm.
I mean, because whatever Retro makes isn't going to sell well in Japan.
Mario Kart 7 sold really well in Japan.
Yeah, but they just made stages.
Yeah.
They purportedly, they made about half the stages in that game.
Unless they're making Mario Kart, it's probably not going to sell well in Japan. DKCR didn't do great, and then the Metroid Prime games didn't do well at all.
No.
So
that's fair. There's a lot of different ways you can look at it. I just thought it was interesting. But the other thing, and I mean, they showed a little thing about Bayonetta 2, but they didn't really show the game. It was
no, they showed enough to creep me the fuck out, though. I want this leather to look like real leather. Do you want to touch me? No. No, I don't.
But they showed a nice trailer for Wonderful 101, and that looks like it's coming along really nicely.
That game looks
and
so fun.
They're still saying that's going to come out the first half of this year.
I want that game so bad.
It might be like a June game, but it looks like it's worth being excited about. But the other really weird surprise that no one could have ever predicted is that Atlus is making a crossover game between Fire Emblem and Shin Megami Tensei.
So can I speak real quick about what my experience was with this?
I'm counting on that because I don't know what to think about it myself.
I'm watching tweets come through because I'm sitting in a meeting so this was airing at, I think it was 9 o'clock East Coast time. I'm sitting in a meeting. It's a stand up. I'm sitting in a stand-up. Fuck it. I don't care. Dude, people are just rattling through their design stuff. I'm like, all right, whatever. I'm just watching tweets come through. And I see this game come up described as a mix, not crossover, a mix of Shin Megami Tensei and Fire Emblem. I'm like, the fuck does that mean? that's all I have to go on. Nobody tweets about this game anymore. It just goes dead silent. I can't get to gaming news sites on my computer because they blocked them at work.
Well, the name of it is pretty much all they said. That's the problem, there was no other information.
Yeah, but see, to me, I just thought they were saying it's an Atlus Intelligent Systems co-developed game that's sort of like a mix of those two franchises. Not like a mix of the characters, but a mix of gameplay styles.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how it reads. And then I get to a quiet place where I can watch these trailers on my phone, and I see the Shin Megami Tensei characters come across. I'm like, oh, so it's going to be Shin Megami Tensei kind of played characters in a Fire Emblem style game. Okay. That's not as exciting. Then I see Fire Emblem characters come across. I'm like, what the fuck? And then they show the logo. I'm like, what the fuck? What the fucking fuck? What are you doing? What? What is this? Oh my god. I watch it again. I'm like, what the hell kind of game is this going to be?
It's a it's a really strange mix. Now,
it's such a weird mix.
This is not as bizarre as Pokemon and Nobunaga's Ambition.
No, it's not.
Yeah, that pretty much takes the cake.
It's definitely a lot less obvious than Professor Layton and Phoenix Wright.
I have to say, Pokemon and Nobunaga's Ambition is the most amazingly insane mixture of
I can't believe that game actually was made and actually came out.
Well, imagine the fact that it came out in the West, of all places.
Yeah, like, it actually came out here. That's Pokemon Conquest, if you're not familiar with it. But
what fever dream caused that game to happen?
Yeah. A lot of sake was consumed the next night that was thought of.
The next night they thought of this one.
Fire Emblem and Shin Megami Tensei
have nothing to do with one another. It doesn't strike me as a bad idea.
I just wonder who thought of this. It just doesn't really make sense. It's not a clash. It's just like, why?
Yeah.
It's like you've got characters from an era where it's like swords and axes, and then you've got people who shoot themselves in the head to turn into monsters. What the hell?
Yeah. I've never played a Shin Megami Tensei game, but I do like Fire Emblem. I look forward to learning more about it. They've piqued my curiosity, to say the least.
It's almost like they announced this game just to see how much we'd freak out about it. Like,
yeah. I just think it's weird.
Yeah.
But it may actually be a troll.
Very well. I mean, it's...
you just put the disc in and it plays itself. You sit there and go,
hey, Nintendo working more closely with Atlus, I'm all for it. I really am. Because eventually I want Nintendo to buy Atlus and start making more Trauma Team
games. It can't cost that much money. Just do it. Just go on a binge, buy Goodfeel, buy Atlus, buy WayForward, and be done with it.
Yeah.
Just be like, all right, we're done. We're done now. Like, just imagine Iwata doing a Nintendo Direct walking out. Yeah, we just bought these three guys. Done. And a Nintendo Direct. And walks off the stage. Our website would crash. And it would not come back for days. It would just be gone. It would be like we've gone back to 1996 and there's no more internet Nintendo news because all the websites would be wiped out by you people.
So let's talk overall impressions. I know for me, if they hadn't shown the Xenoblade thing at the very end, this would have been about what I was expecting. In terms of a typical Nintendo Direct, they kind of announce one or two things that you've never seen before, but they're not really... You know, like the way they're doing Wii U Virtual Console and what it's going to cost, and the, you know, stuff like Yoshi's Epic Yarn, which looks cool, but it was, you know, hardly surprising, very known quantity. And then to do something weird like Fire Emblem Cross SMT is like, what the fuck? You know, but it wouldn't like set the world on fire.
No, it did, but not in like the, oh my God, this is so hype. More in the, what? What?
For me, they're learning maybe the pacing of these announcement videos a little bit better. But to show that Xenoblade thing at the very end was all of a sudden, whatever I did or did not like about the previous 20 minutes of this thing
just didn't matter.
Were washed away and I no longer give a shit because what they showed at the very end was so ridiculously awesome that it's all I can think about or talk about. Mm-hmm.
Here's the beauty of it. They built to this moment. I mean, they put their announcements in kind of like a up, kind of like a back and forth swing.
Well, I thought the Zelda was going to be the big closer. And then when they didn't even show the remake, much less the new game, I was like, man, this really petered out in a bad way.
Mm-hmm. But they knew it. And what's amazing is the Xeno whatever trailer. Xeno something. It's going to be called Xeno something. We don't know what.
John Riccardi is calling it Xeno whatever.
That's a good name for it. Xeno whatever. The Xeno whatever trailer, it builds too. I mean, it's just running, and it's some fighting, and it's fighting some big dude, then it's slashing the stomach of some big dude open and getting sprayed with gross shit. Then it's him jumping inside a freaking mech.
Yep.
And then it's him flying off into the overworld.
Yep. And then fighting a boss in the mech.
Just cutting the appendages off bosses and dealing just insane amounts of damage. Then it's him turning into a motorcycle, getting shot, and as he flails around, turning into a robot and landing on his feet. It's like that's how you end it.
And I hope they remember this lesson and they remember the excitement that they're creating and they do something similar at E3 because that's how you end a press conference, not with 20 minutes of Nintendo Land.
Yeah.
But you know, I think stuff like that makes everything else look better in the end.
Yes. It makes you more excited and it makes you go back and think, well, maybe this other stuff that happened before is okay.
It's cool.
Well, yeah.
I mean, so for me, Wind Waker, when Xenoblade is like maybe my top five, top 10 games of all time. I mean, that game is immaculate. I mean, it's unbelievable in so many ways. Adore this game. If you listen to the show, you've heard me praise this game for hours and hours and hours.
So, James, this sequel or whatever this thing is, you know, whatever.
Put Mex in!
It is now your number one most anticipated game of all time, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you told me there's a game coming out that time. Would do... like if you put me back 30 years in history, I'd still be going, fuck, I gotta wait for this game? God damn. But, I mean, if they added Mex, which is just the personal, like... Yeah. This is like Nintendo said, like, all right, we're going to mess with his head.
They're really poking into your erogenous zones, aren't they?
They really are. I'm slightly aroused.
Something I didn't think we'd discuss. James' erogenous zones.
No.
But there you go.
It's not the first
Nothing
time
is sacred.
That, so. But to pair that with Wind Waker, which may be one of my top three games of all time.
Yeah.
With an HD remake, which is something I've wanted forever. And, you know, I mean, I sat there and pored over screenshots on a cell phone and noticed that the layout of Windfall Island is different. I mean, because I've played that game a lot of times. And, I mean, I just finished Majora's Mask yesterday. And, you know, in my head, I've played Ocarina of Time a bunch of times. I had only played Majora's Mask once. And then Wind Waker. And I played Wind Waker so many times. And it's like... I go from Majora's Mask. I was thinking, God, I kind of want to play Wind Waker. I found myself watching people do Let's Plays on Wind Waker last night because I was like, I missed that game.
Oh, man, you were ready for this then.
Yeah.
Nintendo announces this, and then they announce Xeno whatever.
Yeah.
Done. I'm done. Just take my money. Just take it. Take it right now. Here's my wallet. It's all yours. Nintendo, this is the sound of me banging my wallet on the table. You can have it. Just take it. It's yours.
Happy birthday, James. Hey, I was very pleased by both of those announcements. Not as much as you, but
I mean, and to make me right about my Mario prediction, even better. You guys are the best. Just take it. Just take the money. Go.
By your incredibly safe Mario prediction.
Well, no, I predicted it was going to be a 3D game from the Tokyo team coming out this year, and that they would not release a new Zelda game this year. I think that's reasonably
okay. Sure.
Reasonably out there.
All
so,
right, I'll give you credit for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing for me. It was kind of a lot of stuff that Nintendo confirmed, but we really already knew. So that really didn't surprise me. It was all good news, you know, to hear them confirm stuff like Mario Kart and all that kind of thing. They didn't throw around any dates, so what am I supposed to take out of that?
Mario
Not a whole lot. But
yeah, you're being told that the sky is blue and that water is wet.
Exactly. So I was kind of like, all
but
right.
But that water is so wet. You know? It's so wet. It's such wet
it's
water.
So wet.
It's the wettest water
yeah,
ever.
But of course, you know, at the end, I was like, what, you know, even through the whole trailer, before it hit the mech stage was the key. And then I was like, holy,
yeah, it's,
holy
it's
shit.
Just, it's just your brain just goes, oh.
Yeah, I was like, okay, this is cool, cool upgrade. Whoa, hold on a second. That dude just got into a mech and now he's fighting some.
So you see him running towards
boss.
This kind of menacing looking thing on a hill.
Yeah.
And you're like,
yeah.
Is he going to fight that thing? Oh my God, he's getting
inside. I thought it might be something that he would like run up to and, you know, like it was some sort of door or
thing.
Something that he would open. But I didn't realize that he would actually hop into it and start using it. I was like, wow, that's awesome.
And then he goes apeshit on a boss. I mean, he's devil may crying the crap out of that thing. And then like, it's just like, oh.
All right. So as a wrap up to our discussion and to this segment. If the purpose of this Nintendo Direct was to kind of juice up Wii U sales a little bit and really convince people that this is going to be a viable platform and it's one that they should go ahead and you know, pick up before the end of the fiscal year, preferably, John Lindemann, did it work on you?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see some dates around some of this stuff. Like, I know these games are coming, but when are they coming? I mean, because for me, eventually,
I'm going
to... You can
only just wait till they're out to buy the Wii U.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm obviously going to buy a Wii U at some point, but now, since it's past the launch date, I mean, now I'm looking for an excuse. I want something to go along with it. I don't want to just go out and buy the console. I want something really good to sit down and play with day one. So what's that game going to be, and when is it coming out? That's what I want to know. So they're kind of preaching to the choir with me because I plan to buy the console anyways eventually, but they
want you to buy it now.
Yeah,
that's the key. They know a lot of people will eventually buy the Wii U, but for the sake of their investors and their financial reports and everything, they really need to try to get as many sales as possible by the end of March. And by the way, they don't have any games coming out before the end of
March. That's exactly it. There's nothing.
So that's what this was all about.
Yeah, I mean, this to me, this doesn't change my buying plans for a Wii U going out into the summer. I mean, that's the thing with no...
And virtual console is not a factor for you?
No.
What about that 30 cent crazy thing?
A lot of those games I already have in some way, shape, or form. So, yeah.
But I'm happy to spend 30 cents to get Super Metroid on the Game Pass.
Absolutely.
Such
yeah,
a
yeah.
weird thing they've put
I'm
together.
Happy to do that. I wouldn't spend $8 to do it, but...
It's the 30th anniversary of the NES. Here's Super Metroid.
Yeah. I'm not even sure I'd spend $1.50 to do that, because I've already spent $8 on it. But 30 cents? Fuck it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
It's 30 cents.
I mean, for me, the VC stuff has always sort of been icing on the cake to everything else that the console mm-hmm. does, right? And all the other console games. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So.
That's a good way to look
yeah.
at it. Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's what it's always yeah. been.
For me, it's really thick icing.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
But yeah.
I mean, I love it, but, you know, it's always come secondary to, you know, what games are coming out.
John just eats icing out of the container. It's fine.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. Unfortunately, we couldn't get Guillaume in here. He tried. I think his power was maybe kind of going in and out, but it was never on long enough for him to join the
into
call.
Into ice.
So
he's out of power into ice.
Yeah, man. So now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, it will be the future / the past, and you'll be hearing our live retroactive about Majora's Mask. So stay tuned.
Welcome, everyone, to the first ever live retroactive feature. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
Hi.
And John Lindemann.
Hey, hey, hey.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Bonjour.
And a very special guest, our old friend Greg Leahy.
Hello there. Good to be back.
It's very good to hear your voice, sir. I know people are going to be excited to talk to you. And I'm excited to talk to all of you guys about Majora's Mask. But first, we have to take care of some important business. James really wanted us to do a live version of the Now Playing feature. So that's what we're going to do. And he just put in a script here that we have not seen ahead of time. And we're just going to do it off the cuff. So that, John...
All right.
Well, actually, maybe I should do the little intro. Here's a look at the latest original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right. First up, we have a review of Riding Stables 3D on 3DS by Neil Ronahan. I love ponies, but not little ponies. Horses don't come in purple. No, I love real ponies, and I always wanted to take care of one, and brush one, and cuddle one. But you can't keep horses in an apartment. Now I have Riding Stables 3D. It's good enough. Just like this Nintendogs plus cats plus horses, minus cats, minus dogs. No way this is worth $30. And we also have a review of 101 Dino Pets 3D by Zach Miller on 3DS. If you're a fan of the NES classic Color A Dinosaur, James, you'll be sure to love Dino Pets. Design your dinosaur, dress it up in its Sunday finest, and play awful minigames. You'll love it, just like Zach didn't.
Next up, we have a feature, Nintendo World Report Powered Off, Issue 2. You know it, you love it, Nintendo World Report in magazine form. Enjoy past articles and exclusive content, like John's instructions for summoning the Elder Gods via the poker rap, and insight into James's haunted video game collection, now laid out better than any issue of Edge ever was.
Slammed!
We also have a review for 3D Games Collection by Don Koopman. Sudoku, Find Pairs, and Mahjong are good enough, but Single Player Connect 4 is where 3D Games Collection really earns its 3D stripes. You would think multiplayer would be prerequisite for Mastermind, but apparently it isn't. No multiplayer and marginal 3D makes 25 games of 3D Games Collection passable.
We have a blog, The Triumphant Return of Zelda by Andrew Brown. In case you missed it, Nintendo is going to remake Wind Waker for Wii U. Wind Waker for Wii U. after just a few screenshots, Andrew is in love. Enjoy him castigate those who hate whimsical cel shading with words like whinge. He also pontificates about the fate of the absolutely integral Tingle Tuner. And I'm going to read this as it is written. A review of Unchained Blades on 3DS.
Nice, good.
By James Dawson. Exceed's entry into the 3DS RPG market should be exciting, but turns out that James finds grinding them blades is less than it stacks up to be.
To say the least. We also have a review of Crystal Adventure for DS by Josh Max. Ever want to play an RPG that doesn't tell you anything? Ever wanted to have no story except what the publisher puts on their website and no indicator of how strong enemies are? Of course you haven't. Unless you like roguelikes. But if that's the case, well, then I have nothing to say to you.
And we conclude with possibly the least presumptuous blog ever written at NintendoWorldReport.com, Yoshi's Epic Garbage by Alex Kalafi. Oh, wasn't Kirby's Epic Yarn charming and creative? No, of course it wasn't. It was easy, even for babies. Turns out everything Alex sees about Yoshi's recently announced yarn venture is no more exciting. He even accuses Nintendo of ruining Yoshi's Island. Surely a crime.
Wow.
It's not in Sendieri at all.
Oh, man. Clickbait. Clickbait.
I'm so pleased with how that turned out.
It's clickbait.
Out.
Pure clickbait. We're shameless here at Nintendo World Report.
Yeah, really. Okay, so I just dropped in the notes for Majora's Mask, which means we are actually about to do this thing. I just want to remind everyone that we're going to do a little kind of a setup, talk amongst ourselves for a few minutes here before we start taking live calls. And if you would like to call in and talk to us about Majora's Mask, and I hope that you do, you need to install Skype. There are instructions on the page that you're looking at with the audio stream player in the chat room, and send a chat request and or a contact request and a little message to Zach Kaplan. And his username is there on the page. And when you do that, hopefully he will respond to you and put you in the queue. And he's going to be lining people up for calls. And then he will patch you into here when it comes time to do so. So we're going to give Zach a chance to build up a few people and kind of order them and hopefully preload the first person into the chat room. And then we'll bring you onto the call when we are ready for you. Okay, and TYP assures me that things sound fine and that James is a little quieter than the rest.
That doesn't, keep it that way, please.
That doesn't sound right at all.
I will rectify that problem right now.
Okay, guys.
I figure how to do that without breaking everything.
So let's talk about Majora's Mask. That's the main reason that we're here. And just to remind everyone, the reason we're doing this is because people donated and we met one of our stretch goals during the live telethon for Child's Play back in October. So thank you once again to everyone who donated in that event. You are the reason that we're here doing this. And I really hope you enjoy it. And just to reiterate, the reason that we're doing this special retroactive feature for Majora's Mask is because it was always requested very heavily for retroactive. We never did it because normally we have a poll in order to choose the game that we're going to play for that feature. And we felt pretty strongly that that any Zelda game, and this has occurred in the past, but any Zelda game that we throw in there is going to win hands down over anything else you put it against. So it wasn't really fair to ever put Majora's Mask into a poll. And so because of that, we might never have done it as a retroactive. And I thought it was an appropriate choice for this kind of special one-off game to be used as a stretch goal during the telethon. So that's why we're here. We're doing it live because I just thought that would make it extra special. And, of course, Majora's Mask is the second 3D Legend of Zelda game, the follow-up to Ocarina of Time. It came out in the year 2000 around the world. And it's a very, very unusual game, and I think we're going to have a pretty wild discussion of it here. It's very divisive. It's certainly one of the least loved, or maybe the most loved games in the whole Zelda series.
The least most loved games.
It sold 3 million copies, which was about half the number of Ocarina of Time, and yet I want to say that's probably more than Skyward Sword, but it's still considered kind of one of the black sheep Zelda games along with Zelda 2, and one that a lot of people, even now, who really like Zelda have either never played it or they played it, and then they kind of never got very far into it, and I think that was the case with a couple of the guys here on the panel. It was, of course, made with the same engine and a lot of the same art assets as Ocarina of Time, and the purpose of that was to get another Zelda game done much more quickly. The first one took 4 years to make, and they really wanted to get another one done before the N64 phased out. So they reused a lot of stuff, and I think that informs what the game really is, because it forced them to make the game as different as possible in every other way. And I think you can really see that when you play the game. So, that's a little bit of history here. Also, if you've ever heard of a game called Zelda Gaiden, that is Majora's Mask. That was the kind of the prototype name for it before we got the official one. So, of course, it runs through the three-day structure, kind of Groundhog Day style. Every 3 days, the game ends, and before that happens, you need to play the Song of Time to save and reset to the beginning. You lose a lot of items, but you keep the really important ones, like the masks, the dungeon, the special weapons, all that kind of stuff. So some of your progress is saved, some of it is not saved, and that works into the way that you play the game a whole lot. And before we get started with the real group discussion, I wanted to kind of go around the panel and ask each of you how much you had played this game before we started preparing for Retroactive, and how far did you get in the most recent period as you were preparing for this. So we'll start with James.
Hopefully my audio is better now, but
it doesn't.
Are loud.
Yeah, you're loud.
Too loud? Am I too loud?
Maybe a touch.
Okay, I'll adjust it later.
I think you're always too loud, James.
I am all of the loud.
Oh boy, you are.
So I played this game when it came out. I got it day it came out, played it. I probably burned through it in about a week and a half, 2 weeks at the time, if I recall correctly. Did everything. Was total completionist except for the heart pieces. And then put the game on a shelf and more or less moved on because the GameCube came out. Not that much longer later. I mean, I need about a year downtime between play sessions, and by then we were pretty much on the door of the GameCube. Mm. And then I played Ocarina of Time again because I had the GameCube disc and the 3DS re-release and the Ura Zelda thing.
Yeah.
But never actually got around to playing Majora's Mask again, even though I revered it. So playing it this time was the first time I had played it since within a month of the game's launch. But I had completed it before. And remembered a surprising amount.
and you played all the way through it, didn't you?
I did play all the way through it. So I completed it again just about a few days ago.
Okay. With all masks.
With all masks.
And Guillaume, let's hear a very different tale from you.
Well, the first time I tried to play it was on the Anniversary Collection, the Zelda Collection, whatever. I don't remember if it was Anniversary. Anyway, the game, I think during the first 3 days, towards the end, froze on me. So that was that. I was like, okay, I'm never playing this again.
GameCube Collection was the best.
and then I bought it immediately when it came out on Virtual Console. I tried it. I think that the point I stopped at was that when you get to the forge where you can upgrade the sword, the game so far has told you, basically has taught you, that you can use warm water in a bottle to thaw ice. Mm-hmm. And so I went through the incredibly tedious process of trying to thaw the ice in the forge using that warm water.
I've done that as well. Yeah.
Only to find out that the upgrade that you get only lasts for 100 hits, and then also like you can't make it permanent at that point. You have to have beaten temple. Yeah. But I didn't even know that. All I did was like I saved, and then you lose the sword also when you save.
Yes.
So I was just okay to hell with this game. And I haven't picked it up until, you know, we decided to do this thing. And now I'm just I just finished a Great Bay Temple.
Okay.
And to hell with this game.
Did you get the sword upgrade? get it for real this time?
I do have the sword upgrade this time. But
the baller sword?
I think my Majora's Mask experience has forever been tainted by these false starts. I don't think it's possible for me to ever enjoy it, really, for what it is.
Interesting.
You mean a masterpiece.
Okay, yes. So, John, what's your history with Majora's Mask?
Yeah, I did, much like James, I got it when it launched. I don't recall actually playing all the way through, and I've been trying to, as I've been playing through it this time, I'm right at Great Bay Temple, just kind of going through the preamble to Great Bay Temple. And I've been trying to, with each boss, I've been kind of recalling how far I think I got fairly deep into it, but at that time, something else just came along, and you know, I'm not too sure what other big games were released shortwards, but you know, it's just for some reason it never really grabbed me. I mean, I find that back then I probably tried to beat it with trying to consult an FAQ file, which this time through, I as soon as I get stuck on, I'm like, I'm going to an FAQ file, because I just find the way that the game is structured that
it doesn't really lend itself to a lot of trial and error. Like it punishes you for if you try to kind of go through a lot of trial and error. And there's also stuff that really isn't explained to you. So it's sort of like, okay, well, is this just something I'm doing wrong, or is it just the fact that, let's just say, this NPC isn't here on the second day? So, that's kind of one of the things that derailed me last time.
That's what the notebook's for, though. I mean,
yeah, see, and that's the thing. See,
you get stalker level details of everybody's day,
and that's the bomber's notebook, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's see, not the easiest thing to interpret, but it does keep track of all that stuff as you encounter people.
I came across the sign in Clocktown that tells me that, but it doesn't tell me how to get it. It really doesn't tell me anything in terms of
you
how to
have
get
it.
The notebook. Do I have it?
Maybe you don't. So you could, in theory, play the entire game and never get the notebook.
Really?
I've never gotten just it. Have, you have just it. Have to go back to the hideout. It's pretty easy. I don't know why it doesn't give you it the first time, really. But yeah,
because exactly.
Because they're racist.
In a nutshell, why didn't
they
do
hate?
That for
they
me
hate Deku
start?
Scrubs. They're racist. They that's say true. It outright. You can't join because you're a Deku scrub.
But that's the thing. Right? As far as I was concerned, once I kind of unlocked the hideout, I figured I was. With those guys, I never had to go back there, and there's nothing that really directs you back there to get that notebook. So without that notebook, whatever.
Apart from what James is saying, that once you get your true form back, you could join now. So if you say, well, let's see what happens if I join, then that's what's going to happen. But yeah, there's a lot of other things that you can get on with. That's what it doesn't guide you to it. And this is the thing. Yeah. This is the flip side. A lot of people in more recent Zelda games have complained about the amount of hand-holding that goes on, especially early on, but even throughout. Whereas you couldn't really accuse Majora's Mask of that.
Well, I think it takes it to the other extreme, where it doesn't even tell you that there might be something there that you want to investigate. So you don't even know it exists. And I found that repeatedly throughout the game, that there's something there that I should be checking out, but I don't even, a perfect example is the Song of Soaring, where, because I was trying to play through the game as quickly as I could, right? So I wasn't really doing any, what's over here kind of thing. I wasn't really just, checking out stuff randomly just to kind of, just see what's over there. And so I completely missed the walking through the swamp area, next to the temple, how you can hop up on the ledge and go through the cave and you come out into the big orange mushroom area, and then Kepora, Gibora is over on the side, on the left-hand side, and he gives you the Song of Soaring. I completely missed him. I found him from looking at an FAQ file. I didn't even see him there because he's not in the line of sight, really, like when you come into that area. And it's just stuff like that where, missing the Song of Soaring, that's huge. I mean,
huge. This game would be very hard to play without that because it lets you teleport around all the different owl statues.
Yep. So, so that's kind of my initial experience with it.
Tough. Very tough. By the way, John, you mentioned...
Dismissive.
You mentioned that you might have been distracted by other things. One of the things you could have been distracted by is the PlayStation 2, which was released this very same day in North America as Majora's Mask, October 26, 2000, a day that I remember very well. So, Greg, you're the last one on the panel here, and very curious to hear about your history with Majora's Mask.
Yeah, I played it close to when it came out about Christmas, so it was just about a month or two after it came out in America, and I played it all the way through, got all the masks, all that kind of stuff, and then I have played through it on subsequent occasions. Probably the last time I played all the way through it would have been sometime after I played through Wind Waker for the first time, so still a long time ago, the better part of a decade. But this time I kind of picked back up with a save file that was already in progress, so it's kind of at the tail end of the snow dungeon, Snow Peak, and then I played up to sort of the lead up to the Stone Tower Temple. So a pretty decent chunk of the middle of the game. But I'm very familiar with it, having played it a lot. And it is a Zelda game I have a great deal of fondness for, even though it's not really... It doesn't really comport with the things I typically like about Zelda games, as I typically like there to be a lot of very well-designed dungeons. I mean, the dungeons are well-designed, I think, in the main, but there's not that many of them. and there's quite a lot of emphasis on trading sequences and fetch quests and side stuff and all that, which usually I find kind of slows them down. But there's such an emphasis on it in this game that I feel like it's really embedded into the structure, so it doesn't feel as kind of peripheral here, because that is just a huge part of the game.
Right. So just for me, very quickly, you might have picked up on it with my earlier comment, but I got this game the day it came out and was extremely excited to play it. And I think I might have even had like a free copy from working on the site. That seems unlikely, though, because that would have been right about the same time I joined the Planet GameCube staff back in October of 2000.
And Billy would have been hoarding that.
Yeah, I doubt that I would have rated a Zelda game back then. But I remember looking in the mail for it, so I don't know where I would have ordered it. Anyway, I basically had it the day it came out, played it incessantly, and beat it with all the masks the first time. I don't know how long it took me to do that, probably 2 or 3 months back then. But I do recall that I was very unsure of what to think about the game for the first few hours I was playing it. And I think it was not until probably when I got into the Snowhead area and probably climbing that wall, you know, where you have to use the Eye of Truth in order to see where the ladder rungs are, and getting up there and turning into the Goron and rolling around in the Goron mask.
Yeah, that that's was probably, when things seem to get fun, I think.
Yes. Yeah, because I think the part with the Deku Scrub is really confusing and just very strange, and it maybe throws you into the weirdness of the game a little bit too early on. And the Deku Scrub is hard to use, and he takes a lot of damage, and he's not very offensively powerful. So
that part of the game is really so starkly in contrast to all the beginnings of other Zelda 3D games.
Yeah,
I mean, there's Link to the Past, which pretty much is, bang, you're on. You know, your uncle's gone and it's raining outside and the adventure just starts. But most 3D games, the 3D games have these long preambles, and it's usually, you know, the idyllic start in some rural village somewhere, and then stuff slowly starts to go wrong after you've learned everything. This is much more bang, you know, get started, but there's still a lot of more exposition because of the amount of weird stuff that happens. But I suppose the main thing is it's more like kind of a Metroid kind of start where, you know, you get depowered in some weird way, and then it just throws you into this very stressful situation, especially when you're not really sure, you know, how the time limit is going to affect the way you play, because you haven't gone through the cycle like loads of times as you will. It's completely opposite to other Zelda games, which ease you into the experience. This is, you're stressful and odd from the get-go.
Yes. And disconcerting. There's a feeling of you don't know where you are, and you don't know where you're going or exactly what you need to do. And by the way, you have a very strict time limit. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very difficult beginning of a game. And I think it is definitely unique among the Zelda series for doing it that way. But, you know, the other part about the Goron, I think the reason that that is the part of the game where it really starts to click for me and where I really start to enjoy it, and that falls through the whole rest of the game, is that the first time I played this game was actually at my first E3 back in 2000, and it was the first game that I played at E3. So it has a very special place in my mind. And you have to remember that at the time, we knew almost nothing about Majora's Mask. It had never been playable anywhere. It wasn't at Space World. I think they might have shown a very short video that I'd watched about 100 times, but we really didn't know very much about it. And when I ran over to it, I was like first in line. This is back when I met Ben Cosmina and some of the other people who've been around the site over the years. But I ran over to Majora's Mask, and the first game I played, and I think it had 2 or 3 different options you could choose, which is pretty typical for an E3 feature. You can play this part of the game or this part of the game. Mm-hmm. And the one I chose was to basically, I think it was the Goron race. And
oh
yeah, or it might have even been just kind of an exploration mode, you know, like some kind of timed thing where you have like 3 minutes to just kind of run around the field, but you could play as the Goron. And so this was my first time transforming in a Zelda game, and I got to transform into the Goron, and I learned how to roll up and ride around. And I thought, well, this kicks the shit out of Epona. I mean, why would you ever want to ride the horse now that you can turn into this giant boulder and roll over the enemies? And I just thought it was a magical experience. It was just so different than anything I'd done in a Zelda game up to that point. And so I was really excited about it after that, and that's why I was so highly anticipating it when it finally came out. So we've got several other discussion points, but I want to use those to drive our conversations with the callers. And so, James, if you could pull in our caller, our first caller here, he is in the chat room.
I could do that.
And we'll get going. And once again, if you are interested in calling in over Skype and talking to us, the instructions are on the page below the chat room.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hey.
Are you Patrick?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. So, Patrick, what are your general feelings on Majora's Mask?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm having some audio difficulties.
Okay. If you're hearing anything twice, make sure that you pause or turn off the audio stream on the page when you call.
That was the error. It wasn't working. Okay.
It is disorienting.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, Patrick, are you a fan of Majora's Mask? Had you ever played it before this feature?
Now I'm a fan. So I got it around 2001. I was young then. I played the beginning. As you said, it was disorienting, and mm-hmm. I gave up.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the moon crashed into the earth, and I was like, that's it. I'm done. It came to the Virtual Console. I remember it was like the 300th game on the North American Virtual Console on Wii, and there was all this hype because everyone had been asking for this Super Mario RPG and Earthbound, and so I decided I was going to buy it on Virtual Console, give it another try, and I never got around to it, but my brother did, and I was watching him, and he beat the game, and I was thinking, well, this is fun. I'm going to wait until I forget the puzzle solutions and come back to it. Except I never came back to it. And so now with the retroactive here, I went back and started to go through it. I was like, and then I forgot all the puzzle solutions, and I really was just sort of enthralled by like the three-day system and all the different transformations and the masks, and I ended up just yesterday beating it with the Fierce Deity mask. So
awesome. Yes.
That's the platinum trophy.
Yes.
That's the I've gone way too far, so let's go ahead and ruin the boss fight at the end of the game.
Well, I decided if I was going to do something, I was going to do it all the way.
Yeah, there you go. You did. That's awesome. So you're a total convert then.
Absolutely.
When you were playing it all the way through this time, did you find that there was a point in the game where it sort of flipped for you and the frustration that you had at the beginning turned into satisfaction and excitement for what was coming next?
Once I stopped being the Deku at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, once I was doing that, I was like, okay, now the game's starting to open up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started going, and I was, you know, collecting the masks and trading them. And I was like, especially with the Zora mask, I really liked that mask and that transformation. It would beat the hell out of the Water Temple in Ocarina of Time, so.
Yeah, the Zora mask is interesting because if you look back at Ocarina of Time, the way that Link dealt with water was kind of very unsatisfying. You know, he could either float at the top and sort of dive down to pick up a rupee at the bottom of a pool, but then he had to come straight back up, or he had to put on the metal boots and sink to the bottom, but then he would die if he wasn't wearing the blue tunic. So it wasn't really any different. Like you were either floating on the water at the top, which meant you couldn't really do anything, or you were walking on the bottom, which was similar to how you normally play. There was no swimming. So but to slow. Add the Zora mask and the ability to swim was a big, big difference in Majora.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Patrick. So before we let you go and move on to the next caller, I'm curious, did you have a particularly favorite character or side quest or just a piece of the game that was really stood out as being your favorite?
I'm not so sure about favorite, but I can tell you the funniest thing in the game to me still is the bank system, where if you're in the third day, you can put in all your rupees, and then they'll just, like, write down how much you put in or stamped it in on your hand or whatever it was, and then you'd go back in time, and they would just look at that and it's like, I don't remember you, but that's my handwriting. So, here's all this money.
Yeah,
you're one rich little dude.
I think the artifice there is that he's stamping it on your hand, and that's the reason that it carries through is because it's now part of your body. And so when you go back, it actually stays with you, and it retains how much money you had.
I like to imagine that since I went to the bank frequently, I just had this huge stack of overlapping stamps on my hand. He had to try and decipher them all.
It's like you've been bar hopping all night.
Exactly.
Okay, Patrick. Well, thanks so much for calling in, and we hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
All right. So,
like, isn't it weird, though, that they found a story reason for you keeping your rupees, but not really for you losing every other consumable items, but keeping
because they don't exist yet, because
items?
Time paradox. You're actually robbing that bank. I mean, those rupees you put in are going to vanish, because they vanish off you when you don't have, when you've got them on you. You're just taking money that you haven't actually put into the bank yet. You will bankrupt that bank eventually, but it doesn't really matter because you're going back in time anyway to reset there.
Yeah, but when you go back in time, you keep all your stuff except for the consumables. So
yeah, there's no particularly specific reason why, like, the masks you collect from the dead bosses can go with you and all that kind of stuff that other things don't, but, you know, you just have to accept it.
The masks they drop when they die.
There's quite a number of clever conceits, but they didn't think of stuff for everything by any means.
The mask they drop when they die comes with you, but they're still alive right now.
I think with any movie or TV show that involves time travel, there are always certain parts of the that just don't make sense, right?
Oh, but they do a better job usually, I would say.
Guillaume's really right now complaining that Nintendo
did an amazing job crafting a story.
Is
obviously, it does take your rupees away and all that when you go back in time, but the actual bank system, it makes it a lot more flexible than regular Zelda games.
Right.
Very often, you know, I'll be exploring some like Ocarina of Time, and, you know, even if you've got the biggest wallet and you've kind of hit the top limit of it, and then it's like, oh great, I found a purple rupee or something, and there that's been completely wasted because, you know, your counter can't go up any higher, so it's gone. You've wasted.
Link just burns them or something.
It's in Majora's Mask. If you've ever find yourself with a full wallet, just go to the bank, deposit it, and then, you know, you're free to actually collect stuff that'll come in handy. Now, I mean, there's a bunch of other ways you could game it to get rupees. Like, there's a lottery shop, isn't there, where
right.
you can learn the numbers mm-hmm. and then go back in time and play it. And so money's not really a big issue. It might feel a bit nasty the first time you lose some rupees if you didn't understand what was going on, and then you had to go and forage for some to buy something. But pretty soon, much like all aspects of the game, once you kind of play it, and there is trial and error involved, and it's not always the most accommodating brand of trial and error.
No.
But once you come to understand all the systems, you can manipulate them quite well, and they don't really feel as unpleasant anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, it's like they're just they're more complex, and they just aren't explained. So they let you basically walk off of a and then say, well, hey, you better not walk off that cliff next time. I'm going to let you walk off the cliff a couple more times, and if you don't learn, well, you're just an idiot.
Well, it's one of the things, I think, as well, that was definitely, I think, conducive to me enjoying it the first time I played it, playing it over the Christmas holidays, is that you could just have big play sessions, you know, devoted to it. So, you know, I felt like I had plenty of time to, you know, if I made mistakes or I screwed something up, you know, it didn't feel that bad. I think it's a strange game because the time limit makes you feel like you always want to be making progress, but it's a game in which it's very difficult to know sometimes if you actually are. So,
yeah.
Especially if you're time constrained in terms of how much you've got to dedicate to playing it, that could be quite vexing, I'd quite imagine. I think it'd be much more difficult for me to get into it if I was playing it for the first time now with the lifestyle changes than it was 13 years ago.
I would say a lot of times I would devote the 3-day cycle to a very specific objective. That comes apart from having trying to get all the masks, where some of the masks take a considerable amount of time to actually get. So you would set up your whole 3-day cycle on how many of these objectives can I complete synchronously.
Right. A lot of times you can't even you don't even know what items you need first to complete a quest. Like the quest to get the
sword. It's called learning.
It's not no. That's not what it's called.
It is called learning. You learn what items you need.
It's called
to complete
not having a clue about what you have to do and just doing stuff, hoping that it works.
Yeah, and at some point you're going to get to a dead end, and you're not going to be told that you did something wrong or that you were missing an item. You're just going to be like, oh, okay, I guess I've wasted hours of my time trying to do this too early. But that's not really a nice lesson to get.
Yeah, I think one thing you learn as the game goes on is that you might sort of glimpse sections of other threads, other quest threads. Ultimately, it might seem like you wasted time, but that knowledge, it might get marked down in your bomber's notebook and whatever, and that will essentially speed you through completing something later on, once you kind of understand how the quests fit together. And so it's I don't think it's ever quite as bad as it seems in terms of wasting. You do learn things, and like I said, it gets noted down in the book, but it doesn't do itself favor sometimes. I think the structure, having the 3 days, going back and all that, it'll be the first and most important thing that it does for the game. The trade-off against all this awkwardness and being not very accommodating is that it allows for everything to be scripted, and it makes the world feel alive in a way that no other Zelda game does. You know, I think that's the big upside. But there's some downsides with it, and some of them are not mitigated as well as they could be, because I think they played up the premise a bit too hard. It's worth noting that the game came out in Japan 6 months earlier than it did in America, which made it less than a year and a half after Ocarina of Time, which is a remarkably small amount of time, even with all the asset reuse, as Johnny mentioned. But one thing that kind of comes with it being kind of rushed in that way is it was glitchy and all sorts of things that got fixed for the American release. But you could not say at owl statues in the Japanese version.
Only teleport points.
Yeah, you could. Yes, exactly. So you could. And of course, that isn't like a permanent save anyway. It's just an interrupt save, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. Right.
But in the American version, in the Japanese version, the only way to save was to go back to the beginning of the cycle with the Song of Time. So, I mean, you very much would have, it's all well and good being able to use the special version of the Song of Time that slows time down. But imagine how long you'd have to play continuously if you was going to see the 3 day cycle out in that span, to sit there without the ability to start again. I mean, lifestyle wise, for the Japanese, you know, that would have been quite a challenge. And that's just a case for me of, you know, obviously they did ultimately think better of that when it came to the American version, presumably because of critical and user feedback. But I think it's a case of them, you know, forcing the premise on the player a little too hard, you know. And I think perhaps if they'd taken longer, even longer, to make the game, there's some other aspects of it that they might have made similar tweaks, you know, to make it a bit more user friendly.
Yeah. See, I have yet to save at any of the owls, by the way. I've not.
I use them intermittently, but a lot of times.
I rarely use that feature. Mainly if you're trying to do something like beat a dungeon or complete a very long side quest, and you kind of get halfway through it and you need to get up and go somewhere, it's nice to do that so that you don't lose the progress that you made. But in general, if I do something significant, you know, like get a new item or a new mask, I'm just going to go ahead and play the Song of Time to permanently save it.
Yep.
Yeah, I use my sessions with concrete objectives.
Yeah.
So I would say, okay, I know I can get the bomb mask and the up all night mask in the same session. So,
yeah, you know but you, that
but
you can
James,
get those.
You know that because you've played it before.
Well, I do know that. I do.
That's the whole thing, though. I think the fact that, like, if like those that have played it before, they have a very different view on it than, like, you know, someone who has never played through it, is playing it for the first time, and it's just completely disoriented and really doesn't know all these little tricks and secrets and hints and places to go and what you can do on this day and that day.
And like I said, all of those things the first time for me, you know, how I learned all those things is through, you know, having the luxury of, you know, a couple of weeks off at Christmas and New Year's to play the game very intensely for hours on end. I did also have Sin and Punishment that Christmas. It wasn't the only game that got played, I assure you. But that sort of investment is kind of very difficult to ask of players nowadays. I couldn't see Nintendo asking players to do that now. And some people may say that's dumbing it down, you know, sort of purists and all that, but I understand that. I think if they did a Majora's Mask remake, which might be a bit less probable with the Wind Waker one already on the horizon now, but if they did, I think they would make some more changes in the vein of the owl statues. I mean, first of all, you'd want to make it more portable, you know, in that way, the interruptible, full portable play. But there's lots of other ones. I mean, there's the case with the Great Bay Temple where you have to collect the Zora eggs in bottles, which, you know, it seems to be basically punishing you if you've sped through the game and not picked up bottles yet. Yeah. And I think, again, that's, you know, I'm not sure whether that in this sort of era they would punish you for not having sort of dallied with the side quests and picked the bottles. Yeah, I think that's the kind of thing I could see them changing.
So I hate to interrupt the stream, but we do have another caller, and I want to keep things moving forward a little bit. So, Mike, are you on the line?
Yep, I'm here. Hi.
Hey there. Yeah. So what was your experience with Majora, or do you have any comments or questions for the panel here?
It's a bit of a weird story, actually. Also, I saw the Zelda Symphony in Milwaukee last night, so it's a good day for Zelda. It ended with Majora's Mask music.
Oh, good. They're still playing that. Because when that tour first started, they didn't have any songs for Majora, and people were really upset about it. And so the tour director went back and arranged some songs for that, and they added it to the end.
Yeah, it was very nice. Very nice indeed. Well, I suppose the thing that's most striking to me about Majora, and that's always been most striking, is sort of the melancholy of the game and the in both the audio and just the story. I don't know, who here is able to actually sit through the entire, if you let the third day run out, who here is actually able to sit through the entire sequence of the moon crashing down? Because I find it unbearable.
Yeah, I actually did it because I was told to check it out. And I did it, and it's just, it's pretty depressing.
I've never actually done it. Like, every time it gets to the end, at the last minute, I abort and go, nope, can't do it.
You should hide the controller, and really, I agree with you, Mike. It's absolutely worth watching. It's just not quite like anything you've ever seen in a Nintendo game.
It's just unsettling. In any game, it would be unsettling.
Yeah. Yep.
But for me, my experience with Majora, I wasn't actually a Zelda fan at the time. I had a friend who was very into Zelda, and so he took me through Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask in an effort to get me hyped up for Wind Waker.
Okay. What a good friend.
he was a very good friend. Unfortunately, he didn't. He got killed not too long after, so he never saw
Wind Waker. Oh, wow. That's awful.
Yeah, so. But he did really get me into Zelda, and now I'm hyped for Wind Waker Reborn, and for the longest time, I couldn't go back and replay Majora just because of the memories attached to that. But now I have a lot of respect for that game. I'm still not entirely sold on its level of fun, but it is very interesting.
Do you think it feels more like work sometimes than fun?
Sometimes, but I agree with you that Groundhog Day is an amazing movie. So from that angle, I'm trying to enjoy it.
Yeah. I wonder if you agree with me, Mike, on this theory. I kind of thought about this yesterday as I was playing through the Spirit Tower. But I think the way that the game is broken into these smaller chunks, and your goal in any time you sit down to start playing Majora's Mask and you're starting from the beginning all over again, the goal, kind of like in Groundhog Day, is to make yourself a little better than you were the last time, because you know if you do it in the right way, if you find that new item or that new mask or the new song, then at least you made some progress. And so the progress that you make throughout the game is, I think, ultimately similar to what you would do in any other Zelda game. But because it's broken up the way it is, it feels more incremental. And because of that, this game feels more like an RPG than other Zelda games, because it's all about, you know, like with a traditional Japanese RPG, you sit down and any given time that you play the game, you may not beat the next big dungeon, or you may not hit the next big story point, but because you always make progress as you play the game and you fight monsters, you get experience points, you always got a little bit better, and the next time you sit down, you're going to have a different experience.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's I don't know if min-maxing is the right word, but it does feel, it did always seem to me like the way it's structured is you can mess around and screw up, but you maybe learn, okay, I can shave off a few seconds. It's like learning a speed run, I think. You can shave off a few seconds here, a few seconds there, and slowly you learn that day, and you learn the events, and then you can get from point, by the end of it, you've learned the patterns, and you know exactly where you need to go, how fast it's going to take you to get there, and how much time you've got left.
Yeah. Yeah. Become more efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I actually hosed up the whole Keifei and Anju quest one time because I cut it way too close and went out the wrong door.
Oof.
So yeah, I have to start. That was I was on my way to very late in the quest. Let's put it that way. We're in the middle of day three at this point. Mm-hmm. So stuff's gone way sideways, and I'm just like, I'm trying to get money together because I need a little bit of money at this point. And I realized that I just screwed up by playing the stupid maze minigame, and that actually eats time. And then realized I only had like 31 seconds to get from there to the hotel. I ended up going out the wrong door, and I was like, ah! I just sat there and sobbed for about a minute, and then restarted the game.
That is the really tough part of the 3-day cycle, is stuff like that. You know, I mean, an early example might be, you know, because you got to like get the Goron powder keg and blow open the ranch. You know, and yep. So
every time
you can then have to defend the ranch from the pose from space that want to kidnap cows. And you know,
and
the thing is, if you screw it up, you can't just come back. You know, it's gone for that time. Then you'd have to, you know, start it over again, blow up the entrance again. These are things that in Zelda games you don't normally have to do. You know, once you've opened the way to somewhere, you don't have to do it again. You know, and obviously there's a lot of retraversal that is made faster with items, as it should be. Like, for instance, when you get the hookshot, it's a lot easier to get back into the pirate's fortress than it was the first time, and so forth. But it's still those sorts of things. I mean, sometimes I wonder whether that was part of the point of the cycle. You know, they're making a console Zelda game little more than a year in Japan after the first one came out. You almost feel like they you know, in more cynical motivation, they wanted to stretch the game out more than what substance they had they could produce in a compressed development cycle, you know, that they could make. So, you know, you do wonder whether that's part of the reason behind it. But I think the fact that it is scripted and the fact that it makes the world so much more alive as a result kind of is a worthy trade-off in the end. That's how I feel about it.
Go ahead.
Do any of you guys think that if they did go ahead and remake it like they did for Ocarina of Time on the 3DS, that might actually get some people who weren't so big on it more into it? Because the structure does seem tailored for sort of, okay, short play sessions, learn a little bit, learn a little bit, learn a little bit, and something that you can put away and just walk, you know, put the DS into sleep mode, walk away, and then come back when your patience is restored.
I think the sleep mode makes that easier. I mean, for me, a lot of time I spend with that game, though, in part because I know what I'm doing, is sitting and waiting. Where it's like, okay, I know I need to ambush Sakon here, but he's not going to do anything for the next 3 hours, so I'm just going to stand right behind him, and he's going to completely ignore the fact that I'm just standing there for 3 hours.
I think they could do one of those sort of tune-ups that I think they could make in that situation. For instance, the Song of Double Time, you could make it more, you know, more incremental, so that perhaps you could skip around in, you know, rather than just day-night, you know, make it like the 6-hour increments, and rather than have to keep playing the song, just pick a particular point in the calendar to go to. Yeah, these are the sorts of things that I think would benefit a portable play game, because I think one of the things that I'd be concerned about portable play, if you're kind of playing it sporadically here, like I said, not intensely the way that a lot of us did in 2000, is that you some of these things that aren't that well explained would become even more difficult to keep track of. So they'd probably have to do some things to help you, maybe like expand the bomber's notebook in a way that actually makes it even easier to keep track of everything that's going on.
Like the one thing I think they could improve on 3DS or Wii U would be swapping between masks and having more than one mask equipped at one time.
Oh yes,
that could be kind of a pain. Like, you have to, you know, because, you know, there's quite a few times where you'll have to, in one room, to swap between several masks, and at the same time you have, you know, arrow equipped, and you're just constantly select a different
mask.
And
there's some that I would question whether they should even be masks. I mean, take for instance the Great Fairy mask that's used that alerts you to the presence of the little fairies in the dungeons. Yep. You know, I mean, you don't want to have to keep swapping that on just to know where the fairies are. I mean, that could just become an innate ability that something
But the mask makes the fairies. But the mask makes the fairy think you're the great fairies, and they come flying to you.
I agree with James on this.
Whatever works for you, James.
I kind of like that. I like that it looks ridiculous when you put on the Great Fairy Mask, but then when there is a fairy nearby, that the hair on the mask sort of floats up and glows, and it just looks really crazy. And I think that's an important part of it. But I think you might not mind that as much if, like John said, if they added more item slots, which yeah, I think on the PS could easily do that on a touchscreen.
Yeah, I mean, I played the game.
That would help.
I played the game almost entirely in the bunny hood, so because everything is easier in the bunny hood. You're faster. You jump.
Is a lot easier.
You jump a lot farther.
Yes.
Oh, it's like a cheat mode. It's awesome. I love it, but it means it eats up one of your three inventory slots constantly.
Yeah. To me, like if I were to get me to pay $40 for a remake of Majora's Mask, they would have to rework a lot of the game and a lot of the basic mechanics. Like I've butted heads with a lot of people on the internet since starting playing this game. There's a lot of dedicated fans, but I've heard like, oh, you just don't like trial and error. That's not true. Like I can cope with trial and error in games normally, but rewinding and saving thing is just screws it all up. And it basically,
I think it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the difference between, you know, Bit Trip Runner when you fail and it's just whoosh, you're straight back to the start, and then other games where you fail and you have to fucking go through a stupid game over screen.
Right. Like it's as if you wanted every time you wanted to cook spaghetti, you had to make your own pasta and make your own sauce every time from scratch.
I do.
Well, I'm
because I'm a gourmand.
But you know, because like there's always like some item that you need to get, and to get this other item, to get this other item, to finish this quest. And I'm thinking like mainly of the Moon's Tear. You always have to go get it if you want to get the deed. If you want to get the, you know, trade that for something else. It's really annoying.
No, the trading sequences you just can't really kind of cut back into the middle of because it's all got to follow that script, which is, I mean, well, it kind of lets them split off, which you couldn't do like if it was purely linear. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of friction involved compared to other games, if you know what I mean, sort of like these impediments. And again, it makes it sort of less accessible, I think. And I don't think it's ever, even if you made a lot of tweaks, unless you changed it unrecognizably, will never be everyone's cup of tea or even every Zelda fan's cup of tea.
The hardest thing that I found was, I mean, just playing through the first part of the game, I couldn't understand why. I mean, most of the time, all the other games in this series, they kind of show you what you can do, and you can kind of see, okay, well, if I have an item that does this, probably, like, if I have the hook shot, then I can see that I can get over that ledge, and so it kind of gives you, like, you know, you look forward to, you know, the items that you will get. But this just, it tells you what you can't do, and it doesn't tell you anything that you can do to solve it.
Well, it's inherently less predictable than most Zelda games in terms of, you know, how it's going to unfold and how the items are going to kind of lead you in a progression and all that, which it can be bad from the point of view that it could be opaque and confounding. But
well,
it's
like,
also,
why the hell can't I leave Clock Town? I mean, I need a sword? Shut up!
But you know what?
It's dangerous. He's looking out for you, John.
That's just its way of making sure that you're not gonna, like, if it did let you go out and there was nothing out there that helped you do things, then you'd just be wasting your time.
But you can't. But you start the game with a sword.
That's actually providing some of the guidance that you seem to want more of, John.
That's keeping you out of trouble because it's telling you that everything you need to complete this quest is in the town.
But I would argue that its unpredictability is also one of the things that I like about it, because it was a Zelda game. I really felt like I didn't know what was going to happen next. You know, there wasn't the usual villain, there wasn't the usual structure, and of course that Zelda structure, you know, kind of linked to the past Ocarina of Time, has been done many more times since, so perhaps it would stand out even more to some people today. But I do think, you know, it comes with its downsides, but overall I appreciate it for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think just not being Ganon, even Philosopher Ganon from Wind Waker, makes it somewhat more unpredictable. But it's not like the boss from Skyward Sword, which is just deeply unsettling and unpleasant to be around. I mean, this guy's creepy in a non-sexually invasive sort of way.
Okay, well, we're going to have to switch up callers here. So, Mike, I want to thank you for calling in and sharing your story.
Nice to talk to you guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. And we are now going to James, can you bring in the next person, please? And while you do that, it's a good time to remind everybody that I think we do have plenty of room on the call queue. So if you want to talk to us, if you want to share your story about Majora's Mask, if you want to complain about it, if you hate the game, or if you want to ask us a question about it, please send a message to Zach. The information is on the webpage, and it's in the chat room too. And if you're not sure how to call in on Skype, just say something in the chat room, and someone will help you. So, do we have the next person?
Hello, next person.
Hello.
Hello there.
Ah, identify yourself.
Hello, I'm Alan. Hey.
Hi, Alan.
How you
doing? To the call. So, Alan, did you have a story you wanted to share or a question for our group?
Well, I was just going to talk about my Zelda experience a little bit. I played the first one as a kid, but I was really young, so I really didn't know what I was doing. I just went around and killed stuff. And then I got Link to the Past. I borrowed it from my cousin, but I'd only gotten to the third dungeon because she wanted it back. So Majora's Mask was my first real, like, jump into the Zelda universe, which was it can be very jarring to play that game right off the bat. And never really played a 3D Zelda before. I hadn't had a 64 when Ocarina of Time came out. But I had a similar experience where I think it's that it was Christmas break and I was in high school. And I think that's why I became so much in love with the game. I just had that straight 2 weeks. The game's very much rewards, almost excessive trial and error. I would actually say that it works better if you don't play it in sessions. It works better if you play it all at once, where it's like you remember everything that just happened. Like you said, you might play one part and you might not get anything done, but you remember that. And then so when you go back next time, you can do it faster. Or you remember that I could get past. I was trying to get past it. Obviously, that didn't work. So you go try to do something else. And then later on, that pops back up again. When you're playing it more close together, I think it really helps with figuring that kind of stuff out.
Makes sense, yeah. So, Alan, what was your, when you finally, played this, going through it, I guess you probably didn't have that many preconceived notions of what a Zelda game should or should not have, so maybe it wasn't as surprising to you, but do you recall what was your favorite part of the game or your favorite character or quest that really stuck out to you?
I really liked the beginning of the game, just because it was, I don't know, it was just trying to get back to playing as normal Link was really what drove me. The first time I played through, I actually didn't even get through. It was my first 3D Zelda. I actually saw the ending of the... I actually saw the world in my first playthrough, but just trying to get to that sword and everything was really... I really loved that part, and really the part with the inn as well. I don't know why. For some reason, I just love dealing with that kind of romance side quest. It's like every time I tried to see if I had enough pieces to get through it yet. And it just that throughout every time through the game constantly, it was like, okay, do I have all the pieces I need to get these two back together again? And I definitely wouldn't. So I just really liked that quest went almost throughout the entire game.
It's the first thing you see when you come out of the clock tower is the little guy, the Keaton mask, checking the letterbox. Straight away it's sparking the curiosity. You know, that's the other thing, because people aren't just standing on spots waiting for you to talk to them. Whenever something is happening, it's notable, and you are making those mental notes of it. And of course, that's one of the first cases, and then it is really quite a complex sequence to get through. And I think that's a very common thing. Very many people that I've heard of play Majora's Mask, the whole Kefi Anju resolution is one of their favorite things.
It's like, I think it's probably the most emotionally satisfying quest in the game, and it's the one that you have to put the most effort into, but it's also so complex and difficult to see it to its conclusion that I wonder, you know, how many people play this game and actually complete that without resorting to some kind of FAQ online. I don't think I ever did. I think I eventually had to go get help for it because it's so difficult to figure out what to do next and how to make it all happen in the amount of time that you have.
The part at the end where you have to help him in Sakon's cave, that's really where the game doesn't give you much guidance at all. He tells you there's a thief who he knows more or less about. Unless you've already seen that area, which you could totally miss because it's off the beaten trail. It's on a cave to the side. So unless you've seen that area, you could totally not have no idea where he's talking about.
Yeah.
And you could beat the game and never go anywhere near that place.
It's a quest that a lot of people who love Majora's Mask seem to have completed, though, because whenever you hear about that game from someone who's a fan, he's just like, oh, that game, like, it's probably the most emotionally satisfying Zelda. Like, you really get to know the characters. You help them, and then you rewind the time, and it doesn't stick, and, you know, like, you feel sad, and I gotta say, I'm not really feeling that for the weird dude, like, dancing naked on a rock, or, you know, the weird dancers I teach his dance to, and the hand coming out of the latrine, or,
it's,
you know,
such
like,
an awful dance, too.
Even the
hand
girl
coming out of the latrine.
Yeah, or the girl, like, saving the cows from the UFOs. I can't say I've developed a connection for any of them. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah. so that's actually another one.
I don't really see why you should be sorry about it. If you don't, you don't. If there's no reason to be.
Well, see, also, actually,
if you didn't play this game back when it was first released, it might be harder to appreciate now because the storytelling methods that they had back then were so much more crude than what we're accustomed to these days. And I think, you know, at the time, the kinds of stories they were telling with these side characters and the kinds of the ways that you were getting very intimately involved with their lives in some cases, it was just something that you had never really seen before, especially in games that actually came to the West. I mean, if you think about Japanese dating sounds, some of these other things where you try
I'd rather
to develop
not.
Some kind of personal relationship with other characters in the game, I don't think that it really existed in the West before Majora's Mask. So it was an experience that most of us had never had before, and it might have made more impact. If you go back and play it now, it's, I think, maybe harder to appreciate that kind of thing. Alan,
yeah,
did you play through it again just recently?
Yes. I didn't play through it recently because of time restraints, but it's probably my favorite game. I played through it, I think, all the way through about four times, but
wow.
I completely agree that it's a game of its time. As much as I love it, games aren't made like that now. They don't have that kind of, at least most games don't have that kind of, you don't know what to do. It's not going to tell you what to do. You really need to spend a lot of time just kind of throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah,
I think
see,
if the game was made,
and that's the thing. Like, I'm finding that too because, for example, you know, the guy that you know that whole quest you guys are referring to, I have no idea that even exists because I've never been in Clock Town long enough to actually observe somebody checking that mailbox.
But you've been trying to mainline it, John.
You're pointed right at him coming out of the fairy fountain,
mainlining it, and not trying to observe anything around me either.
It is very difficult. I think you might just need your eyes checked rather than anything else.
You could
run out of there as fast as possible. You're still going to see him with the mask on, but whether you're kind of paying attention to
never,
it.
I just try to get away from that stupid, annoying dog that always knocks me over. I fucking hate that thing.
The dog.
It's a question. I don't want to graze over this because it's an important point. I think what John's getting at is that sometimes you may see characters doing things and may not realize that it has any significance. And especially if you don't have the notebook, then you really may not know that it has any significance. And it's very possible that you can miss.
The thing about this game that's different from other Zelda games is that the characters are not just doing the same thing over and over again a lot of the time, you know. So when you see something, when you see them doing something, if Andrew's just walking across Clock Town or something, you know that's if you just see her there, you know that's significant. That's one of the things that's really important. I think the fact that it is scripted and that it isn't just they tried to reprise some Majora Mask kind of elements in Skyloft, in Skyward Sword, didn't they, with the gratitude crystals and all that. But one of the reasons why it was sort of weak and partial is because, you know, it is just a case of people standing around and, you know, there's a sequence to it maybe, but it's still just triggering events.
You don't feel involved in their lives.
Well, it's not even so. In Majora's Mask, I think the fact that everything has this sense that it's going on whether you see it or not means that when you act, it actually feels like intervening in events rather than triggering them. That's the big difference. And I think that, actually, I mean, you could say it's a game of its time, but it very much was, but that's relatively unique to this day, even though many other things about it have sort of faded into relative crudity with its storytelling. I think that's still kind of something you don't get from a lot of games.
So, for me, one of the ones that actually did it for me, we talked about it a little bit, but we didn't think of it as one of the ones as a good example. The whole ranch situation, I don't think a lot of people go back on day 2 and day 3 if they fail or if they succeed on day 3, to see what's going on in that ranch. But if you go back on day two, you have Kremia basically just heaped over in a ball, distraught over the fact that her sister's been kidnapped by yes. freaking aliens. Yeah. And if you go back on day three, before the moon falls, she's basically drugging her little sister. She's giving her the adult milk, either for some reason, either because she's going to die and she knows she's going to die, or because she's trying to distract her from what is about to happen. It's a really unpleasant place to be in general. but you do feel somewhat invested in that because you realize, wow, this is kind of sad. Even if you succeed, it's sad. And if you fail, it's really sad. So it's just bad all around. But
it's a sad game.
It is. You really.
It's also we might be melancholy, but it's also macabre. I mean, there's a lot of about the fact that you're kind of playing as dead characters, the mummified guy with the Gibdo mask, all this kind of stuff. It's kind of there's a little more of a kind of almost hot, very weak, obviously. Yeah, but there's a little horror element to it that other Zelda games rarely have.
And there's also the fact that Link is really a jerk. In this game, because he helps those people, quote unquote, but he never really helps them. He's just getting what he wants from them, and then rewinds time.
But then all of that ultimately leads to him becoming some sort of juiced up, roided monster that comes
That's right. He's not the nice deity mask. He's the fierce deity mask.
And then he saved everyone at once. That's true.
He didn't save their piddly little problems. He saved their world.
He has to save everyone one at a time so that he can eventually save everyone at once. That's the game.
He's really saving himself.
Greg, someone earlier mentioned Groundhog's Day, and it is. I think my love for that movie is part of why I also love Majora's Mask. And actually, I think they kind of synergize each other. Like, the more I experience both of them, the more I appreciate the other. But I wonder if maybe some of your appreciation of Majora's Mask is linked to stuff like David Lynch, which I know you're a huge fan
of. Yeah, we mentioned that kind of link before. Obviously, a lot of it's just because it's so surreal, and there's definitely some kind of allusions to Link's Awakening, which is explicitly a dream, but you know that this is a dreamlike place. Just the fact that, all obviously, this ties back into the whole asset reusing thing, but the fact that all the characters are people that were in Ocarina of Time, but they have different names, or now there's three of them, or they have kind of a exactly, but just dreams in general, you know, people kind of swap around in your head and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of its surreal qualities.
Yeah, very nice. Well, Alan, I think we're going to have to let you go, but thanks so much for calling in.
All right, thank you for having me.
All right. We've had some excellent callers so far, and I think the next one is going to be great too, because he's been teasing us all week on Facebook that he was going to call in, and he was really excited to do so. So, James, let's try to bring in Vastille here. I think it's Austin.
It might be.
And should be ringing. Austin?
Hey, guys.
Hey there. Welcome to the call. Welcome to the show. And Austin, you were the guy on Facebook who's been promising to call in, right?
Yep, Christmas Day, actually.
I thought so, yeah. So I know you've been really excited. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with Majora's Mask or your relationship with it?
Well, I was 6 when I first bought my first NEX system. So, my N64, that is, and it came with both of the 3D Zelda games on it, and I beat Ocarina of Time when I was 6, and that was a fun game, honestly, but Majora's Mask kind of hit a chord with me, because I felt like it was the first game that was trying to be more than just a game.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, for me, honestly, I hadn't played a lot of games before that because my parents are kind of against that stuff, but it was my first experience with a game that was trying to show emphasis on story and character progression and stuff like that. Not go here, do this, come back, so you can do this other thing.
And as a child, when you first played this, do you recall finding it very frustrating or confusing and hard to find what the next thing to do was? Or do you think maybe children just have more patience for that kind of thing because they have so much time to spend on it?
Oh, no, it was the first thing. I remember getting stuck in the forest temple and leaving it alone for 6 months.
Wow.
It was unimaginable for me.
And was there a point later in the game where, I mean, obviously you came back to it at some point, but do you remember where the game really started to kind of make sense and really start to work on you?
Oh, definitely. Like, as I was stuck at the Forest Temple because I could not figure out where to light those damn torches, I ended up going back and playing some side quests. That's what pulled me back in instantly.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Very nice. But at that point in the game, you still have so many side quests that you can't even attempt, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, the other side of that is that I think you could get through the Great Bay Temple without getting any of the non-transformational masks. So it doesn't kind of, you know, guide you towards them as much as it could as well. Again, it's kind of what John, you know, so what John is saying is that, you know, it's not a very guided experience. You can really not touch that stuff at all. Or, you know, you can like try and get invested in them. But the problem is like if you hit upon, you know, a certain amount of walls with some of them, I mean, some you can kind of, you know, get going on and then others you can't. And again, you don't really know. So I think, kind of, right now, going into Grey Bay,
I have the Don Garrow mask in one bottle. That's what I have, aside from...
Yeah, and it's a lot less fun when you like that, because at first we have to make a lot of return trips to get those Zora eggs, which, you know, that's...
Dude, spend five minutes and get the bomb mask. That bomb mask is unimaginably useful in that game.
Yeah.
Man, I barely remember the bomb mask. On my current...
You press a button and your face blows up. What's there to forget?
Yes, but it's weird that putting up your shield keeps you from losing health. I have no idea how. It just does.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally optional. It's a nice to have, but almost all the masks are nice to haves. And you can actually beat the game. I'm sure there are like minimum mask run throughs on YouTube. And that would actually be kind of interesting to see, because a lot of the masks are helpful in certain things, but they're not required to do it. And you know, it would be difficult to play. I mean, a lot of them, if you don't really go out and look for them, you'll never get them. And those are probably okay, but a lot of them are kind of in the way, but then they're optional. You can choose to just kind of go around them and find other ways of doing things. So you can sequence break the game in a lot of ways, but also Majora's Mask is the kind of game where, on one hand, a lot of things are very sequential because of the timeline, but then in another sense, there almost is no sequence. You can do so many things out of order, and it's so open-ended and so nonlinear in its own weird way that I'm not sure sequence breaking even has a meaning when applied to a game like this.
Well, you can go to the Shadow Temple early. I mean, that's literal sequence breaking, because you actually can get some things to make the pre-Zora Temple dungeon stuff really easy. But besides that, yeah, I mean, there's not a ton of it. I've seen the list. I think there are three masks besides the transformation ones you have to get to beat the game, but that's it.
Yeah, the first one I can think of is when you go to the Icarna Valley and there's that ghost guy, and he explicitly says, if you haven't got the mask that you get from racing the Gorman brothers, whoever they are, you can't come through. So that's pretty, you know, you've done three of the game's four dungeons at that point where that gets thrown up.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually cleared the Forest Temple the first time this playthrough and forgot to go back to the Great Fairy to get the Great Fairy masks. So I had to actually go back in to get the stupid fairies, because it's actually kind of... The things you get for collecting them are almost always really, really worth it.
Well, you know, the other thing about the game is that with the four dungeons, in a lot of cases, I think maybe in all the cases, you can play up to the point where you get the big item from the dungeon. So if you get the magical arrow for that dungeon, you can leave the dungeon at that point and probably just move on to the next one. So,
yep,
you really have to have some discipline to go back and actually fight the boss and beat the boss and get that mask, because otherwise there's really not very much stopping you from just moving on to the thing.
I mean, you could plow through some stuff like that in Ocarina of Time as well.
That's true, yeah.
So it's not totally out of sequence. There may be some non-story events that don't trigger because you haven't killed that boss, though. But in Majora's Mask, the story events aren't conditional on the boss being dead, because the bosses aren't dead. Usually you reset time.
Although you can always go back and kill them quickly, can't you? Because there's like a portal. Once you've done it once, there's a little warp at the start of the dungeon entrance. You can go and fight them again.
So on this playthrough, when I went to kill Majora for the final... went to the moon, essentially. I did a handful of things. I got the Chateau Romani, because that gives you infinite magic, because I was not going to have to deal with that bullcrap in the dungeon. And then I just went and killed the four bosses, mostly because it would make sense at the end of the game when the world was back to normal. And I had time to do it. I had time to kill. I was like, I've got some time to kill. I'm going to go warp and kill some bosses and then hang on back and see what happens. And ultimately, like, you could kill. So I jumped to 6 hours before the moon, or 12 hours before the moon falls, 6 hours before the clock opens. So night the last day.
Mm-hmm.
And then went and fought all the bosses and still made it back to have to wait a little bit for the door to open.
Wow.
I mean, that's the kind of time we're dealing with here.
James is a super user.
Well,
of course, if you slow things down, I mean, you've always have plenty. I can't really imagine like not being able to do a dungeon in one go if you've played the inverted Song of Time, because it does give you it in real time. I don't know exactly how long it is, but it's plenty.
It's over 3 hours.
It's 2 hours 15 minutes.
Greg mentioned the warp in the dungeon. I have to say that I missed the fact that that existed. So I, you know, for the forest temple, what happened is that I somehow managed to get all the fairies the first time, and I also managed to very like in the nick of time managed to follow the butler around when you finish that quest.
Oh,
and so when I exited, when I saved. And when I went back there and I saw, like, oh, great, the swamp is toxic again, I was convinced that you had to do the whole temple again.
So I had no
idea that there was, like, this big of a shortcut, and so I never bothered. Like, I was like, oh, screw that. So
it's my understanding that our guest is something he wants to speak about. Can we get into that?
Yeah, Austin, yeah. Please. I know you had another point to make.
Yeah, I'm really into story in video games and all that, and I feel Majora's Mask does that impeccably. And it starts off very well by completely tossing you in the action and basically showing face-to-face the enemy, the big boss, at the very beginning, even though it's not straightforward, the big boss, being that it's still attached to Skull Kid and all that. I hope I'm not spoiling anything for everybody out there. But
it's like a 13-year-old game. You're fine. Don't worry about it.
All right. So it builds that up, and then as you go, you keep seeing him, and your little fairy friend wants nothing more than to get to him at the very beginning of the game as well. So, but then as you go out through the world, you also see people who he's hurt in the same way he hurt you. Mm-hmm. He stripped you down and made you a weak little piece of plant so you can roll around and spin and jump, but everyone else he's marred just the same. Between Kayfee and Anju to, I don't think he had anything to do with the UFO setting, but the big rock in the
I don't know, it's kind of an odd situation.
So it's like, I guess you kind of feel a kinship with the other NPCs who he's hurt, because he hurt you in the same way early in the game.
In fact, every person whose mask you're wearing, of the transformation mask, are people he hurt.
Exactly.
Right.
And the Deku one.
The masks are a really interesting kind of memento. As you play through the game, you get more and more of these masks, and each one belonged to someone who was really messed up, and you help them in some way. And then you take their pain, like the Gibdo mask is a great example, because you take this awful, really bizarre situation of the girl who her father is like turning into a mummy, and he's locked in the closet, and she's trying to protect him from the outside world. And when you help them and you solve their problem, you now take his problem, which was being turned into a mummy, and now you use that and you to your advantage to move forward through the game.
So like at the very end of the game, for every mask and side quest you've completed, it'll show you a small clip after you've beaten the game, and for the ones you haven't, you just get the mask you didn't receive revolving slowly in the darkness. So I feel like it's a little bit of a treasure to keep that you've helped those people out.
Yeah, I was actually going to move towards that, because the Goron and the Zora that you get, both of those individuals died more or less trying to fix whatever garbage that Skull Kid under the influence of the mask did. In the case of Daruna, he died trying to stop the blizzard that had overtaken the mountain. And in the case of the Zora, whose name I forget, I believe he died in I believe he died in the currents or in that nasty water stuff that they had done. I can't remember.
He died trying to retrieve Lulu's eggs.
The eggs. That's right.
Yeah.
And so, hadn't the Deku that ended up.
So yeah, they don't say that right off.
So it's at the very end. It's the butler.
It's the finds. Very last shot of the game.
Yeah, the butler finds like his son's corpse. Like I don't know how that corpse ended up being the same kind of person that Skull Kid turned you into. That's left kind of unexplained, but the implication is that it's fundamentally similar to the other two. That that Deku you turned into was a person at some point, the butler's son.
It actually goes back to the conversation the butler has with you at the end when he says that he raced you because you reminded him so much of his son. Well, then at the end, right at the spot where you got the Deku mask, there is a corpse of a Deku that he's crying over, implying that you remind him of his son because that's who the hell you are in that mask.
Yeah.
Which
it's really a weird, very, very creepy kind of element to Zelda that you're occupying these dead people. You know, you're becoming some version of them after they're gone in order to complete what they were trying to do when they died.
And what's really odd is that's how they chose to end the game as well. That's what they picked for their last shot of the game is one more melancholy gut punch.
But
the very last shot is that little play of Zarya's song.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
it's not quite that much of a down.
It's the second. It's the second to last shot then, because it is the last of
it's
the.
It's really
of the,
close. Yeah, it's just as you're going back,
and then you go in the Black Lodge, and everyone's speaking backwards, and I don't know, something blows up. So Austin, thank you so much for calling in. We're gonna have to move on. We've got a couple more callers lined up here, but I really appreciate you calling in.
All right, thank you guys. I'll be in the chat.
Great. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
All right, you too.
All righty. So James, can you please call Spencer?
I suppose I could do that.
It's interesting. So far, all of our callers have been very positive on the game. I know we have at least one coming up that will.
It's a sort of selection issue there, isn't it, people?
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's some selection.
Or a non-issue.
Everybody's
probably
high-fiving from Majora's Mask. Congratulations.
I high-five.
I don't discount the possibility that someone could be so enraged by it that would motivate them to call in, but a positive emotion is probably a better driver in this case.
That's true. So, Spencer, welcome to the call.
Hey.
Hey there. So, Spencer, what's your history and kind of overall opinion of Majora's Mask? How do you kind of come into this conversation?
Well, I've only actually played it, like, once. Sorry, I'm a little nervous.
It's okay.
I just had a subject maybe for you guys to talk about, being that you guys have been in this the internet fandom sites for quite a while now. I was wondering what the internet scene and fan sites were like back then. You know, I remember the reason I listened to you guys at all was basically because I read Windy Man's mailbag every day on Instant Donation.
Oh my god.
Oh.
I haven't thought about that in a long time.
And I remember them having a huge redesign for Majora's Mask.
Oh really? That's cool. So
yeah,
they just reshelled the whole website as a theme for Majora?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. They did have really good graphic design in Nintendo Nation back then. Really good.
Oh yeah.
So are you asking more like what was the internet like at that point?
What you guys had to deal with and the behind the scenes type of things, you know?
Well, I mean, I wasn't writing yet, but I mean, I was heavily versed in the internet at that point, and most of what I would say was the internet was like dumb crazy town because people were still figuring it out as they were going along, and a lot of sites would put up like two images.
Majora's Mask was an interesting game in the sort of the internet circles because it had been out in Japan for so long that people had loads of time to kind of that were willing to brave the Japanese text, or maybe they understood it, you know, they could actually read Japanese to actually play it and pick it apart and have it kind of all dissected on the internet way before, you know, the game was actually going to come out, which, you know, that kind of period of time is not necessarily, you know, there's not that many games that applies to that are as big as Zelda, because gradually those big localization delays have, you know, tended to get shortened with the worries about piracy and just, you know, online spoilers, all that stuff. So it's a kind of a weird intersection where you had a kind of vibrant fan scene, but you still had a major Zelda game with a 6-month gap. But yeah. I did try and stay away from the really spoilerific stuff because I didn't want to, you know, I really wanted to enjoy it fully as I had done with Ocarina.
I mean, what I would say is that it was better than it had been just a few years earlier, but there was a decisive lack of visual content. A lot of what you had was reading.
Yes.
Because sites didn't want to have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of images up because bandwidth cost a ton of money at the time.
It was also quite rare to find video footage of games, especially unreleased games back then. Because
there wasn't a YouTube. You had to upload a video file to your server, and
it was very expensive to provide video on a website. Actually, there was a long time on our website where Billy wouldn't allow us to put up video because it cost so much every time we did. Because, I mean, we had a huge audience. You know, we were the biggest Nintendo fan site in the world, and anytime we put up a video, especially if it was, you know, breaking news or some kind of exclusive video, something out of Space World or Tokyo Game Show or something, people would flock by hundreds of thousands to our website, and we had to pay for the bandwidth, and he would get these bills for, you know, $10,000 for bandwidth. It was really crazy. So we were specifically prohibited from putting up video before we checked with him in advance. And that was true, you know, even back in 2000, it was just difficult to post video. And so I remember even in the late 90s when I was getting excited for Ocarina coming out, I had never seen a video of Ocarina before the day I got that game, except for the early version that was on that old Nintendo Power VHS that they sent out. And that the stuff that was on that video didn't even end up being in the game. They showed Link getting the Triforce and stuff like that. So and the other thing back then is that, you know, there weren't as many official sources of information, especially online, it was much harder to tell what was real and what wasn't. And that was one of the things that originally brought me into being interested in doing this stuff, is I wanted to help people sift through all the false rumors and actually get factual information out there, because especially with Nintendo stuff, the rumor scene was more active than the news scene was, and it was very hard to find out what was real and what wasn't. And that all came out of Ocarina of Time for me personally, but, you know, people putting Triforce quests and stuff like that online, and it became pretty obvious fairly quickly that none of them were real, but so many people were getting duped. And I think by the time Majora's Mask came out, actually, we had GameFAQs by that time, and so you had people actually documenting how to play the game. And then Majora's Mask, that's really, really important, more so than it had been with Ocarina. And I think that's kind of where the thing was. It was, you know, that we had message boards, but there were no podcasts. Right. There weren't very many walkthroughs. There was very little video. There certainly was nothing like YouTube where anyone could play the game and put up a video of how to do something. And so a lot of it was text-based, back-and-forth discussions of how to play the game, but also what the game means to you. You know, so that was kind of the style of things back then.
Well, at the time, there weren't even really many websites either. There was like N64.com and then a bunch of fan sites, really.
Which is still stunning that Nintendo didn't have N64.com.
IGN owned that website.
I know.
Yeah, they got bought by IGN, if I recall. It was independent, and then they got bought by IGN.
Yes.
Right, yes. So IGN Nintendo, you're right. IGN Nintendo used to be a separate website called N64.com. And then IGN bought them, and they became the Nintendo channel of the IGN network.
Were they being run by Mirabella before the buyout or after? I can't remember.
Oh, no. Mirabella –
Captain Messina, wasn't it?
Totally different. He worked – Mirabella – so Fran – Fran, back in around the year 2000, Fran ran a website called Dolphin Cove.
And that's right.
It was very good and very famous rumor site for GameCube before GameCube even had a name. And so Fran didn't join IGN until a couple years later, I think, when Matt needed some help. And so that was the person he hired. And I was excited because I knew Fran before he worked at IGN. I knew Dolphin Cove. I had met him at E3 one year. So I was really excited that someone I knew and who was really good at covering this Nintendo stuff got hired by IGN to help them out.
That's what the internet was like back then.
The one thing that was kind of interesting to me about it, though, to the extent that I was able to kind of get a sense of this, obviously it's a lot less powerful and immediate than it would be now, is just how other Zelda fans were enjoying it. I had one friend that I knew that also played the game, and he really liked it. But in general, it surprised me how many people did like it. Because I liked it personally, but I felt like more people would respond poorly to it. And again, maybe it was just the vociferous voices online in those days were the happy people. You know, maybe that doesn't sound much like the internet, though, does it? But still, maybe that's just the way it was back then, or maybe I just have rose-tinted glasses on. But it reviewed incredibly well across the board, and a lot of the fans seemed to like it. And you know, as much as I liked it, I still found that somewhat surprising because it was contrarian and kind of awkward and stubborn in some ways. And you know, I mean, and some of that, as is the case for me with like a lot of really just outright challenging games, did make it more rewarding when you do stuff like completing the Anjun Kefi thread and just getting all the mass and fishing and all that. I did feel like it was more rewarding and rewarding in a different way from Zelda games that normally are, but I didn't think that as many people were going to feel the same as they actually did.
Yeah, and I might have mentioned this before, but I feel like this is a game where maybe the general perception of it has actually become less unified over time and less positive over time because, maybe more people who weren't – I mean, if you bought an N64 game in the year 2000, you were a hardcore person.
And don't forget, it was the expansion pack only, so that's
– Oh, yeah.
And it didn't come with it built in. So well, you really had to want to play this game to play it back in the year 2000. Over time, as they've given away copies of it, and it's become very cheap on Virtual Console, I think more people have discovered it, and maybe more people who are less devoted to the idea of playing it and finishing it when they first start out. And so maybe that's why, over time, you hear from more people who really don't like the game or who never could get into it, that they never got far enough into it that it clicked for them. Or they maybe, I don't know, are there people who play through this entire game and don't like it? That I wonder about, because I do feel like the more you play, the more you like it. The more you understand it and the more you experience of it, the more you have to appreciate it. And I wonder if there's anyone who's actually beaten the game and still doesn't like it.
I'm sure there must be, because some Zelda fans would probably be willing to plow through, like waiting for it to click, even if it isn't. But I could still imagine for some it never would. But I agree. I think once you get past some of those sort of esoteric elements, it gets easier to like. But that doesn't mean that everyone's gonna like it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I found that once you have all of the tools to actually traverse the way the game lays everything out, like once you can, go back and forth time easily, warp here and there, then you can just say, oh, okay, well, now I can sort of, move around with this structure a lot more easily. And that's when it becomes fun. But if you quit before that, you're going to have a very, very low opinion of the game, I think.
Yeah, I could see that. Spencer, do you have any parting words before we move on to the next caller?
I was thinking about it. I've been playing Spelunky this year quite a bit, and Binding of Isaac last year. Do you think this has maybe helped with the resurgence of roguelikes, maybe? Do you see any similarities between the two?
No, because one's good.
The game I'm surprised hasn't come up in the conversation yet is Dark Souls, because it's been so ubiquitous in the gaming community over the past couple of years of people talking about that. And I think a lot of the things that people enjoy about Dark Souls are things that they would probably also enjoy about Majora's Mask in terms of the opaqueness of what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to do it, and the sometimes unforgiving nature of it. And yet everybody says about Dark Souls is that once you kind of figure out what it's doing and how to survive within the very harsh world that it presents, you start to feel like you're making progress and it becomes incredibly satisfying. And that is the way I feel about Majora's Mask. So I don't know that – I mean, roguelike isn't – it's an interesting comparison because in a roguelike game, you know, when you die, you lose everything and you only have the knowledge – that you gain from that playthrough in order to help you get farther the next time. Majora's Mask isn't that brutal because it does let you save a lot of important things, and it has to in order to tell the story and to help you progress to the end. But it is similar in some ways. It's just not as extreme as that.
Right. Well, you saying Dark Souls really makes me, you know, I haven't played Majora's Mask since it came out in 2000. So, and I love Dark Souls, so.
Hey, yeah. I do definitely recommend, I think, especially if you haven't played it in you know, since it came out 13 years ago, or, well, I guess a little more than 12
more
years
than 12,
ago.
More than 12,
yeah. Yeah.
Although it's nearly 13 in Japan. That's in April.
Oh,
so
well,
it's,
yeah.
It's 12 and change, yes.
It is a very rich experience, and I think it had only been maybe 6 or 7 years since the last time I'd played it, but even then, going back through it, I'm finding there were a lot of, especially the details and the sequence in which things happen, I had forgotten about. And a lot of the puzzles in the dungeons, I get there and I don't remember how to solve it, and I really kind of have to resolve it all over from scratch again. And it's been a very interesting experience. There's a lot of stuff in the game that I'd forgotten. You know, I had this kind of overall recollection of it, but a lot of the details had been sort of lost to time. And I do definitely recommend going back and playing it. And the other thing, and we talked about this, I think even back during the telethon, when we were talking about, you know, hopefully we're going to be able to do this feature, is it's a game that really hasn't been replicated since then. So there really hasn't been anything in the Zelda series or otherwise that really tries to do what Majora's Mask does. And so I think, you know, for that, if nothing else, playing this is an experience that that you're not going to get from any other game. So if you haven't played it in a really long time, it's very rewarding to go back just for that reason alone.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, you have a good day.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for calling in,
Thank
Spencer.
You. Bye.
So we are going to queue up the next person, and all right. I think we're going to have some fighting words from this caller.
Good. I'll have some hanging up words.
Some hanging up words. James, can you please call Donald?
It should be doing it right now.
So that's Donald, also known as Shaman. You might remember him from a recent episode of Radio for Nintendo as a guest. And, of course, he's also the host of Nintendo Free Radio, which is a very funny offshoot. So, Donald, I know you are not a big fan of Majora's Mask, and I would like for you to tell us why.
Well, it seems like every Zelda since Ocarina has done something in the early game that's really ticked me off. Wind Waker has the stealth section. Twilight Princess has the water temple. But Majora's Mask, I've really developed a problem with abilities. Like, when they strip everything away at the start of the game, it's like, okay, fine. Both when I first played it on the GameCube, and then again to try to contribute something to this feature, I just walked away. Just... that.
At the very beginning.
Yeah. I think I've played the Song of Time twice, and that's it.
Oh, yeah. This is so sad.
So wait, hold on. Wait. Pause button. Have you now or have you ever enjoyed a Metroid game? Because if your answer is yes, you're a big baby.
Nope.
Good.
It's curious to me, you call it an abilities, and I know they do show the scene at the beginning of Majora where Link loses his horse and he loses his bow and arrow and he loses the ocarina, but these are generally not things you would expect to have at the beginning of any other Zelda game.
I don't know why, he just finished a quest with them.
Obviously, you know, when you finally can actually play in the beginning of Majora, you are as the Deku Kid, and so it's not like other Zelda games in the beginning, but certainly, you know, it's not like, you know, even once you turn that into a mask and you become Link again, you don't have any more or any less abilities and items than you do at the start of any other Zelda game. Is it just that they show you losing all that stuff? I think they mainly did that for timeline continuity between Ocarina and Majora. They kind of want to show that this is the same Link who came out of the experience at the end of Ocarina and had all of those things.
Only now he's a child who can use a bow and arrow instead of having to use a stupid slingshot.
You know.
Somehow.
It's a good size bow.
Somehow he has learned to operate a bow.
I thought that Dunnel meant when you rewind time, losing all your stuff.
Well, no?
That's not really an ability loss, except for your ability to have to get more arrows. No, I could say early in the game, losing arrows and bombs and stuff is a much bigger pain than later. Because once you have an opponent, you can just run around and just collect that stuff for a couple minutes and be good to go.
Yeah.
Or you just spend rupees to buy. Because it's like, I think it's 30 rupees for all the arrows you can eat buffet. At which point, you're pretty much in good shape. But, yeah, bombs are a little bit more pricey. But, yeah, I mean, at the very beginning... So I think it was the second dungeon. I ran out of arrows, and then I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God, I don't have any arrows. Oh, this is awful. I had to go all the way back to town, buy arrows.
Usually, I mean, if you walk to any owl statue, you could bet there'll be sort of strategically placed sort of shrubs that if you cut them, you'll get bombs, you'll get arrows, you'll get a fairy, pretty much all your starter kit stuff. But obviously that is a bit later on when you're zipping between owl statues.
Yeah, right, and because of the structure of Majora and the fact that you do lose everything at the start of every day of every 3-day cycle, this game is really, I think, the origin of the idea that, you know, whenever there's a puzzle that requires a bomb, they'll put a bomb nearby that you can get for free. And I think that it's even more the case than in Ocarina or Link to the Past or any of the previous Zelda games, because they knew that you may warp to this place and you may need to solve this puzzle without having a bunch of stuff in stock. And so they provide what you need and it's always nearby. And that has actually carried through beyond Majora, and now it's very common in all Zelda games for that to happen.
Yeah, and you typically get hints, like if you can't figure out what's going on, if you hit a shrub and you get arrows, you're like, okay, I probably have to use the arrows in this room somehow.
Every shrub in this room is spitting out arrows.
It's like, I wonder.
Sometimes it's even more blatant than that when they have those choo-choo things that actually have arrows in them. So you've got an enemy that's basically screaming, shoot something with the bow and arrow.
I am an infinite supply of arrows.
So, Shaman, I certainly respect your opinion, and if the game turns you off at the very beginning, I cannot say I'm surprised, because, you know, as we've talked about, the game is very brutal in the beginning, and it takes a while before you really start to feel comfortable with what's going on. But I just wonder, you know, it sounds like you've played very, very little of Majora and yet have a very strong opinion of it. Has anything that we've been talking about, has anything that's come up convince you that to maybe give it another shot, maybe try to be open-minded about it?
Originally, I was in the Guillaume camp on this. You know, it felt like, especially the trial and error stuff that he was mentioning on Twitter this last week. But I do want to get through that game, because it's a lot like Metroid Prime 1, honestly. It's another game I wanted to get through but just gave up on because I got messed up pretty early on.
Oh, that's going to involve the phrase finding keys.
No, that's very late in the game. Well, I definitely do, because it's a special game. It's everyone's cup of tea, but it is a very special game.
Here's what I'd suggest to people who really are struggling with the game and stuff like the trial and error system. Just don't bother with it. Sit down with the guide and go through it. It diminishes the experience somewhat, but I still think that seeing the stuff, even if you're just reading how to do it, is a really positive experience. It's worth it, I think. And there are websites that have really, really, really good guides out there right now.
If you get stressed out by that stuff, just get an FAQ and just go through it, because I've found that this game, it can really frustrate you because it doesn't really tell you what to do and where to go to do key things. And if that really, really bugs you, just get an FAQ file. Because typically it's like, once you get past something, like I would say, if you can stick it out until you beat Woodfall, just beat that first temple, and then from then on, things get much better. Up until the first temple, it's pretty much a pain in the ass, I found. Just the way you have to, you know, you're not really told where to go necessarily. You can easily screw things up. And the fact, like, we talked about the Butler quest, that was the point where I almost quit the game because
he's too damn fast.
Well, you come out and you're told, hey, go over to the shrine. There's a gift over there for you. And you're like, oh, awesome. Finally cool. You know, I've finally done something.
It's Christmas. Yeah.
The game is right. It's Christmas. You go over to the shrine, and that is the biggest pain in the ass. I couldn't beat it.
And I'm just like,
they, and I mean, I think there's just, there's too much of that stuff in general, like, you know, like following people, like little mazes and mini games and all that. And it is because they are kind of padding the game out, which is, you know, often a complaint of mine about Zelda games is when they, and I think with this one, especially because the compressed development cycle, they felt under pressure of like, okay, we're going to churn something out pretty fast and we want to make it feel like a kind of epic experience, even though it's going to be a different kind of epic experience. We want it to feel like it's sort of on the same scale of Ocarina, and so they do some of these things that are busy work, and you know, like you're just that are there to kind of slow you down. And I think, I mean, a more streamlined Majora's Mask that really embraced the fact that it wasn't the typical epic Zelda quest, but was something a bit weirder and more personal, could have been even better. But they were just trying to, you know, it's clearly something Nintendo feels very strongly is that a Zelda game should take a certain length of time, because they always put these things in there to just slow you down.
So they always have Miyamoto go out and brag about how it's take 60 hours to play through it.
Yeah, and it's just, especially in this, you know, which was, you know, when it was called Zelda Gaiden. You know, it doesn't really seem like a Gaiden, get an offshoot, a side story game, shouldn't really have to conform to those sorts of standards at all. So I think there's no doubt in my mind that it is flawed in some of those ways. But, you know, you certainly can love something despite its flaws, and I do in this case.
Yeah. Okie doke. Well, Donald, I hope we've inspired you. I hope you'll give it a shot.
I'll certainly take another crack at it. I just also want to say, there are some things I've said in the chat I don't regret, but there are some things that have happened in the chat room today that I definitely regret.
someone linked to cosplay of Girahim from Skyward Sword that is deeply unpleasant. deeply unpleasant.
Listeners will not be subjected to that.
right now they're just coming up with takes on the Fire Emblem Cross. Shoot, I can't remember. She should have got me 10 sets. They're just coming up with other possibilities, which is much less alarming.
Metroid Cross Choaniki. Very nice.
Metroid Other M Cross Style Savvy is my favorite contribution so far, personally.
Okay, well, Donald, thanks for calling in. I do hope you'll give it another chance. And if you want to hear about his further exploits with Majora's Mask, I'm sure you will be able to over at Nintendo Free Radio, right?
Yep, nintendofreeradio.podbean.com. Hopefully it works for you, because it hasn't worked for me for the last 2 weeks. I don't know why.
Yeah, and you can also keep up with Donald over at the official NeoGAF thread for this podcast, Radio for Nintendo. He does a great job of managing that and keeping it up to date, and I really appreciate that, man.
Thanks.
All righty. Thanks, Donald. So I think we are getting into the home stretch, guys. It's about time to wrap this up, and I just wanted to leave some time here at the end to give our panel here one last chance to kind of talk about the game, maybe get some things off your chest or any topics that didn't come up during the live calls. And I want to start with Guillaume, because, Guy, I know you've really struggled playing through this game. You've been a very good sport because you were pretty – biased against it right from the start. Now,
I don't
know
if I was a good sport. I've been whining the whole time.
Just wait till we get to retroactive China Warrior. Then you can whine.
You played through about 3/4 of the game. So yeah. I do appreciate the time that you put into it and the persistence. You know, especially playing a game that you don't like is an unpleasant experience. It really is.
Hopefully a rare one. Otherwise, you'd have to be a masochist, wouldn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I usually give up earlier. In fact, I gave up on this game twice before. So it's really, you know, it shows you that I was not really looking forward to this. I did make it past the Great Bay Temple, which Johnny said that it was his favorite temple and dungeon. And I think that the game was getting a little bit better at that point. Like, the puzzles were definitely interesting. But, and this is something we didn't really touch on, but the N64 Zelda games are kind of janky in many ways, and not being able to...
There's definitely some camera issues with the
armor. Oh, yeah.
The thing is, I think especially because the camera was not perfect in Ocarina of Time, as everyone will know, but because you have things like the Goron mask and the Zora mask that inject radical changes in the mobility of the characters compared to Ocarina, the camera system is not that fit for purpose anymore.
Yeah, so
and there's a moment in that Great Bay Temple, you know, the mini-boss with the multiple eyes, so it's kind of a reprise of A Link to the Past boss with the big guy surrounded by little ones. That can very get annoying. Very bad with the camera and the slowdown. Motion blur because N64 graphics just have to be blurrier. It's pretty
actually
thing to lock on and to shoot the ice arrow, and it's really, really annoying. And I died also against the boss of that temple because it was you have to aim at the fish that's under the water, so like the camera doesn't latch onto it very well, and I don't know.
Oh, Georg, yes.
And also, like, trying to swim back to the middle platform against that boss was really...
It's infuriating.
It is. So you missed it. You missed it this week, but I actually described the process I went through beating that boss off air this week, which is I went and used my fairies to double up my health and then got, like, 4 fairy bottles and then said, all right, dude, I'm coming at you with like 16 times the number of damage. Bring it, son.
That's kind of like camping, you know, by taking out an entire caravan of supplies.
But, I could have just stood there and let him hit me and still.
Some of those things probably could get cleaned up in a remake, but again, the compressed development cycle didn't do any favors, and just the fact that it is more ambitious gameplay wise, you have more variety with the different transformations and all that. It stretches the limits of that Ocarina infrastructure a little bit.
The engine probably could have used with more of an upgrade. It is an upgraded engine. I mean, all the interior environments are modeled in full 3D. They're not pre-rendered.
Yeah, there's no more of the static pictures. Yeah.
The draw distance is much larger, so they can draw larger environments without filling it up with fog. And, you've got more characters moving around on screen, including just NPC like Clock Town, I don't think could have been done, period, in Ocarina, just because of the number of characters who might be around on the screen at any given time, and the fact that entire town is done in 3D, and with, you know, if you think about to the Hyrule Castle town in Ocarina, is a big pre-rendered GIF.
It's a giant JPEG.
And so the fact that Clock Town is a fully 3D place that you can explore every single nook and cranny, and it's actually three-dimensional, and sometimes you have to climb up on top of a building to get something, was really exciting to me at the time. It was a very significant upgrade over the previous game. But right. Guillaume, just to get back to you, I wonder, you say that the puzzle started to make more sense. Did you feel that your opinion of the game evolved over the course of this playthrough?
I still feel like the game is kind of broken fundamentally, and it's not really. I don't enjoy being stuck there and having to solve a full dungeon and with a time limit, and I just don't enjoy the structure at all.
I don't really see the time limit ever impinged on my ability to go through a dungeon, though. That's the one thing I did that never. I mean, you could still interrupt, go to an owl statue. My experience
with the first temple was, trying to get all the fairies the first go, and trying to do that quest at the end. Like, people have told me on the internet, I never ran out of time. I don't understand it, because my impulse when I'm playing this game is to try to get as much shit done as I can before I rewind time. Because I really have no idea exactly what steps I'm going to have to retrace and what I'm going to have to do all over again, So I don't know. Like I was for the first temple and a half, let's say, I had like this fear of saving at the wrong time and having to do all this stuff again, and that really kind of that really made the time limit stress me out. And
I can see that, and I think it's something that it's probably a lesson that most of us learn as we play through the game. As you're going to get burnt probably a couple of times early on, and then as you kind of learn what's a good breakpoint to save after, then it will take a lot of that stress out because you'll feel a little bit more comfortable about it. And just as a tip for people. For people like Donald who haven't really played it before, first off, I do recommend slowing down time, especially when you're going to go take on a dungeon. I certainly do not recommend trying to get all of the fairies the first time through. I think you should probably
beat the dungeon. I'm a baller.
And then go back again for the fairies, if you do the fairies at all. They're totally optional.
But you should, though, because they're totally badass.
They give you some nice perks, but you don't need them, and it's very hard to get all of the fairies and beat the dungeon in one period unless you've done it before. Mm-hmm. So if it's your first time playing through the game, split those out separately. You'll be a lot
better. The same time, you know, like you're doing the dungeon, I was doing the Great Bay Temple, I ended up with like 12 of the fairies just because you see a chest, you want to go get it. Like that's what right. you do in Zelda yeah. games. So yeah. there's nothing really to, like, you can't really separate completely those two things.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I, with the exception of the Deku Temple, did get them all in the first pass, because you literally cannot get them without the mask in mm-hmm. some cases, because they'll just fly around like idiots. But it's hard. I would say that if you're thinking about playing the game with a guide, that would be one reason to do it. Because, I mean, people will tell you, okay, to get the fairy in this room, do this. But,
right.
I mean, it's just a matter of, do you want these power-ups? Well, one of them gives you effectively twice as much health, another one gives you twice as much magic, and another one gives you a badass sword. So, yeah, I mean, it's your call. I can't remember what the fourth one does, so it must be lame stuff. But, yeah, it's right. it's and fun. Like, what was that?
The whole, I don't know, like, the game wears me down, and it's not just the temples, it's also the quests. Like, I did do the UFO quest, and, you know, like, I was following a guide, and the guide, I don't remember what it was telling me, but I did save after that quest. And then there's another one involving the bigger sister.
You have to do the back-to-back.
Yeah, exactly. So I would have to fend off those UFOs again.
Sounds like you had a crappy guide.
Well, yeah, I don't feel like doing that. And I, you know, like, even if I had been playing without a guide, I certainly would have saved afterwards and not known yeah. that I really shouldn't. So, yeah, I don't really want to keep playing this. Like,
hint for people who are stuck trying to do the UFO quest, because it can be kind of tricky. Mm-hmm.
Well, slow down
time. It makes a huge difference. I know it means it goes on longer, but it's totally worth it. Don't ride the horse, because the horse is a distraction. Use the bunny hood. Do that, you're fine.
It's pretty hardcore, James.
It's super duper cheating mode at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I actually finished it first time with the horse. And
nice. Were you slow down time or not?
I must have been, I suppose.
Yeah. Because they move really fast at regular speed.
Okay. But yeah, so like the quest itself wasn't really that bad. But, you know, like, yeah, as we've mentioned earlier, there's like, you have to wait before and after, like, training. And like, it's...
Yeah.
I don't want to do that again.
Fair enough.
So there is a point with the quest for the sister later that you can come back and do it once you get the Goron Brothers mask. Because then you don't have to do anything. You just sit there and ride. It's awesome. It's so broken. It's great.
Well, Guy, I really do appreciate the effort you put into it, and if you don't want to keep playing it after today, I'll understand. I think you gave it the old college try, and you definitely contributed to the discussion, so thanks. John Lindemann, I know you also were not really looking forward to this very much.
No, well, I know where Guillaume is coming from. A lot of times I just felt like, you know, I just wish the game would get out of my way and just let me play it, instead of making me have all my ducks in a row to do whatever I actually wanted to do. Because one of the things I always look forward to from this franchise is just being able to kind of go out into the world, explore, see what's around, you know, see what I can do, sort of kind of piece together, like, different places I can go, what I'll need to get this, what I'll need to get that. And you can't do that at all in this game, really. You can see kind of hints of it, but they, like I said, they always tell you what you can't do, or you're always basically shown what you can't do, not really what you can do.
It's the haters, John. Haters.
And at the start of the game, I mean, I know some of the emails I sent out were just rageful, just because I was like,
awesome.
So many stupid, arbitrary things that the game was forcing me to do just because that's the way you're supposed to play it. Not because, you know, just, you know, everything from, you know, losing your bombs, rupees, arrows, like that, and not really being warned about it. And, you know, until you do it a couple times, I mean, the first time you do it, crap, right? But then you'll forget to, you know, put them in the bank or something like that. And then, you know, you go to save. Crap. Well, there you go. I lost all my friggin' rupees again. So now I'm back at square one. Even though they are easy to get, it's still the fact that I have to go through the trouble, which is just grinding, of going and getting them back again. There's just stuff like that where the game kind of forces you to do that over and over again. And just because you get used to doing that and you know to do that doesn't necessarily mean it's okay. It doesn't mean I like it from a design standpoint, right?
There's MMO joke to be made here.
That's fair. I mean, honestly, I think if there's ever a remake of Majora's Mask, one of the things they could do to make it maybe more inviting is just take out the bank and just make rupees one of the things that you don't lose.
See, I kind of like the bank, though. I mean, it kind of works in the game's weird, twisted sense of self.
Yeah, I mean, like, I didn't
ultimately
mind it.
Affords you more flexibility with your rupees than you have in regular Zelda, because you can just build up a massive reserve of rupees.
I think I have the 5,000 you need to get the piece of heart right now.
Because you're no longer constrained by your wallet size anymore. Personally, I think that works pretty well, but you've got to get to know how it works and how you could game it, you know, as it goes along.
That's the thing. I mean, and I guess I think that's the problem that people that don't like this game have, is the fact you do have to get used to the way the game works. It's not... And that's not hand-holding. Like, you have to, like, figure out, like, you will get screwed over and you will get punished several times when you first boot this game up if you've never played it before. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
It really apologize for it at all. But I will say that as you go forward and as you get these tools that let you navigate the game in ways that are, you know, quicker, easier, faster, then things start to open up. So I must say, definitely, like, I like the game more now that I'm about halfway through it, much more than I did at the very start. At the very start, I'm like, Jesus Christ, just get out of the way and just let me play this game and stop punishing me for not adhering to these arbitrary rules or, you know.
The thing, I mean, the Zelda games are usually so good about just reinforcing your expectations, you know, that it's like just, you know, putting on a well-fitting glove again, but this one isn't. That's the really big differences.
It intentionally disrupts your expectations for what it's going to be like.
Even if there could have been just a couple of points, like just where if it would have just said to me, hey, by the way, when you do this, this will happen, probably would have made it.
I really do think I just go back to the way they handled the saving in the Japanese version and all that. You know, I think they wanted to stress you out. They wanted to screw with you to start with. They always wanted you to have a negative reaction. And to the extent that it succeeds in doing that, it doesn't necessarily make it a good or a bad design decision. But that was the intent, I think. They almost try and oversell how, you know, restrictive and how important this time limit is. Because again, by the end, you know, you're gaming it three, you know, every way from Sunday. You could skip to all these different parts. You could pull together all these side quest threads. You know, you're the master of it. But at the beginning,
it feels like the game is teaching you to break it over time.
But at the beginning, it kind of wants you to feel like, oh crap, I got to get this done. I got to get this done. When in fact, it's not actually that bad. And that's why I think people, and some people are just averse to time limits in games in general. You know, you see this with the Pikmin 2 divide, you know, who likes it better and all. Some people don't like being put under stress and all that kind of thing. It's just, you know, that's not what they play games for, you know. But on the other hand, I think there is merit in it, in how it makes you play the game, you know, it makes you play Pikmin, for instance, differently, you know, considering it is something of a resource management game. When you bring time as a resource to manage, it does change it. So, I mean, I think with Majora's Mask, in the end, a lot of that stuff's overplayed, but what it could do is, you know, make the experience for some people, I think, more negative than it really had to be. But I think, you know, I don't think there's anyone to blame other than the developers for that. But, you know, that's what they were going for. And I think that's bold. When you think that this is the sequel to a game that sold 7 million copies worldwide or whatever it was, you know, this huge, critically acclaimed
game of time,
system,
you know, 40-point from Famitsu, etc.
And you know, and also the fact that it is a game in some ways. It was like, God, we spent so much time and money making that game. Can't we get something else out of it, please? You know, the very kind of, you know, cynical, commercial kind of underpinning to it.
Seven million sales wasn't enough, guys.
To actually then go, well, hang on though, let's not just, you know, do something that's kind of by the numbers. Let's do something that might alienate people and might, you know, that is, you know, quite admirable for me. Whether you really got that much of it or not, I think you have to sort of credit them for going out on a limb for something to make this kind of concept work.
I mean, no one would ever call this Zelda 64 2, even though it has so much in common with, you know, Ocarina. I think they succeeded and giving it its own identity. And I think Greg makes a great point in that it's a game where the design is intentionally uncomfortable and distressing, and it is something that you've never seen before, and they force you to deal with it in sometimes very complex ways of interaction and learn it over time. And I think the fact that we have this diverse set of reactions to the game and people come out of it. That's why I keep asking, like, what's your experience with Majora? Because I feel like every person who plays this has a different reaction to it and a different kind of experience that they internalize. And I think that's probably what Eiji Aonuma and the other guys who, and, you know, Yoshiaki Koizumi, who now runs EAD Tokyo and makes Mario games, I think that's what they wanted. You know, I think they have to be happy with the fact that some people hate this game and some people just don't understand it. And then the people who do totally get into it, a lot of them really adore it for being so weird. I think that's what they wanted. And I think that's what appealed to me about it from the very beginning, is that I just couldn't believe the risks that they were taking with such a high-profile game. So we just heard from Greg, and James, you're kind of last up here. I know you adore this game. Do you have anything else to say about it?
So just thinking now of the conversation that was going on, timeline check. They were making this game at the same time they were making Eternal Darkness, right?
Sure.
They were in a dark-ass place at that point, weren't they? Like, all right. Let's make really stressful, really dark
world, especially in Japan and St. Catharines, Ontario.
Well, I suppose apocalyptic things were very popular around 2000. Like
it's just really odd. For me, so adapting to playing it on the VC was actually really kind of an odd experience. At first I kept trying to play it like a dual stick game, which was funny. So I'd go adjust time and blow myself up with the bomb. Or try to adjust the camera.
I had the same experience. It was like,
set off a bomb. I'd be like, oh shit. And then
it's like drop a bomb. I didn't want to turn into a Goron. Oh.
Should have played what I did with the N64 controller on an actual N64, and you never get
nice.
Caught. Yep.
But it took me a little while to get used to the visuals as well, but once I did, I was in good shape there.
Yeah.
I just, because I hadn't played this game in 12 plus years, and it's kind of amazing how much stuff I just instantly remember about it. Like, before I even get there, it's not I have a visual reminder. I'm like, oh yeah, that's a thing. It's more like, so I clear, I clear the Great Bay Temple, and I'm already starting the process. What stuff can I do now? Like, okay, I've got stupid elemental arrows for some reason. I've got hookshot. I've got other things. What am I going to go do? Well, I can go try to game break some other stuff. Let's go do that. And then I'm out to try to get some quests going. It's kind of amazing that I remembered that much. I don't remember that much about Ocarina when I played the 3D version, and I'd played that not that long prior. I do wonder if it's just the weirdness of that game made it instantly more memorable, and if that's part of the reason people who really like this game really, really, really like this game.
Or maybe you had just done the steps 100 times before during your first playthrough.
Exactly. Unlikely, because I was playing that game like a boss.
It's true. I mean, the repetition of the game, there are certain things that you do in the game that you will have to do over and over again because of the repeating structure. And I think that does drill certain elements of it into your memory and makes it more memorable, but also just the distinctiveness of, there's so many pieces of this game that are so strange and they're just so bizarre that I think you have to remember them. You know, the visual elements, some of the characters, the mask salesman has to be one of the best characters Nintendo's ever created. And then not only is he a creepy character, and he has
created
this bizarre design. He's got all these masks hanging off his back, but the way that they shoot him, the cinematography of those cutscenes, where the you never actually see him move. He just sort of warps all over the place, and the camera is always at these really strange angles when they show him. There's something just very unsettling about it, and they set that up from the very, very beginning. That this game is very dark, and it's not a happy game. It is not a game to make you feel good. It's a game that really kind of makes you scratch your head and think, why did they make this? How did it come to be like this? What is wrong with the people at Nintendo who would make a game like this?
I think when you realize they were involved, some of the people involved in overseeing this game were also overseeing what was going on over at Silicon Knights, you realize there's some depressing shit going on in that building at the same time. What's going on?
I think the only person really involved with both was Miyamoto, who I don't think of as being one of the more twisted individuals.
I know, but
Maybe,
can you?
Maybe he is.
what's funny to me about the mask salesman specifically is that his face really is a mask. He never animates between them. He just has different emotional masks he's wearing.
Yeah.
And his emotions change with the mask that his face is constantly. It really makes him – you kind of feel like, okay, I can go get this mask back for him, but should I really give it to him? I'm not sure this is a good idea. And they sort of settle it by saying at the end of the mask lost all its power, you're like, oh, thank God. Yeah. You're like, wait. Where's the fierce deity mask? Did he walk off with that? Oh, I hope not. Where'd that
He's
go?
An untrustworthy guide through the game.
When you walk up and show him masks, though, and his commentary on them, some of those are really upsetting.
Oh, that's right, because you can go underneath the clock tower and talk to him anytime you want. If you take different masks, he'll have different reactions.
He'll kind of explain how they work and then have some kind of thought to go with it that's usually kind of like, oh.
Something a little off.
Like, okay, yeah.
That's a really good way to wrap up the conversation, actually. So I'm glad we came back around to the moon.
Well, actually, there is one thing we do really quickly. We didn't talk about the moon at all.
Well, you know, it's always there. I mean, I think the moon is the one part of this game that everybody knows about.
No, but I mean, when you go there. The actual setting foot on the moon.
True. So since James you just beat the game this week, why don't you describe that place a little bit? I have really ethereal memories of it from a long time ago.
Yeah,
but...
so you play the Oath of Order, and you get this pretty long segment where you see all four of the Guardians show up, and they all throw their back out trying to hold the moon in place. And then the mask pops off Skull Kid's face and basically makes fun of Skull Kid for a little while. And then warps up to the moon, at which point Link decides, I'm going to go after it. And everybody around is going, this is a bad idea, guys. He's like, no, I got this. And you're right. He goes and gets on the warp, goes up to the moon.
The clock disappears at that point, right?
Yeah, the clock's gone.
Yeah.
The screen goes all white, and then it sort of fades in with this white hue, a hill in the distance, a grassy hill with a big tree on it. And then if you get closer, you see there are kids running around wearing the masks of the bosses, including Majora. Playing tag, and the Majora one's just sitting there under the tree by himself, lonely. It's really unsettling.
It's a pretty amazing scene. Yeah,
it's bizarre. I mean, it really just feels so out of place. And when you understand, and I don't want to spoil what the motivation between the characters is at this point, but when you understand where the Skull Kid came from, that scene makes a lot more sense. But at the time, you probably don't even process it, even if you know, because the game will tell you if you follow a certain path of progression. You're still just like, I don't understand at all what's going on right now. But you give these kids running around masks, and then you get to compete in these tiny dungeons that test your skill with the transformations, and then ultimately your reward, if you do it all, is you get to get the Fierce Deity Mask, which is the ultimate in OP. Which is why I'm sad it's never been used in any other game, because it's just ridiculous, stupid, crazy stuff.
How has that not come up in Smash Brothers as a final Smash or something?
I don't know. I mean,
pretty good. It would be great.
He literally, when you're fighting Majora, you Z-target him, and then just press A until he dies.
Yeah, it makes you ridiculously powerful.
Because
doesn't that happen in Wind Waker as well, and then you just press A until Ganondorf dies with the parrying?
Well, that's true, but in that one, then you stab him in the head, and he gives you a philosophical discussion on the nature of death. Yeah. It's a slightly different experience all around.
No, he just gave you a weather update.
That's true. He does that as well.
Well, we probably shouldn't be spoiling Wind Waker right now, since a lot of people are going to be playing it soon. But that's going to have to wrap up this feature. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Everyone in the chat room, everyone who called in. Thank you so much to Zach Kaplan, our assistant, who's been bringing people into the chat and adding them to the call. I really appreciate your support, man. And we will talk to you another time. And, of course, thanks to our very special guest, Greg Leahy.
Thank you for having me.
It made this all that more special, and I really appreciate you being here, Greg. So that's going to be it. If you missed part of the show, we do have a recording of this, I think, and we're planning to – make it part of episode 323, which should be coming out in just a few hours from now, or maybe tomorrow, depending on how things go with editing. We also recorded a whole thing about Nintendo Direct, so if you're listening to this live, you can look forward to that as well. It's about an hour worth of content that's going to precede this recording. So that's all. Thanks again so much, and we'll be sure to let you guys know on the podcast when we get ready for the next retroactive. It'll probably be in, I don't know, a month or so, maybe a month to 6 weeks. But we will plan to keep this feature rolling on because we love doing it. So that's it, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye, everyone.
Later.
Bye.
Next time, China Warrior.
Can we make Dark Souls the retroactive
no!
game?
No! No, we can't!
No. Hell no! No. Are we still streaming, James?
I'm shutting it off right now.
Alrighty.
Bye, guys!
Later on.
Speaking of starting to drop.
Yeah, Guillaume is about to drop in here.
There's going to be like a huge gap in audio between when us transitioning to Guillaume's arrival and him actually being ready to go.
Well, it's okay.
So if you're still listening out there, audience, Guillaume's not here yet. Because
we need to, let's see.
He should still be in the chat, so he should be able to just get...
I don't think he is.
He's in the chat because he's sending us messages in the chat.
I don't see them.
You don't see still recording, really?
Oh yeah, I do. Do you want me to just click add people to this call?
She should already be in it. I mean, you should just be able to hit call.
If he could find it.
Oh, let's see if this works.
Yeah.
Guillaume!
Well, he hasn't answered yet.
He's always looking up. I don't.
He is. It looks disgusted,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like he's just about... He's getting his ass kicked in Black Ops 2. That's what he looks like.
It looks like it's post.
I never met a guy that I couldn't forget until I met a guy named Kiefer J.
It's, it's his face is one of post...
Yeah, he's
anal
like
reconfigurement.
Yeah, it looks like it. It's like, oh man, I can't believe that other clan just killed us like that.
I think he's looking to the future. That's like his
looking
Obama
to the future.
Poster.
Well, he has no future in this call. I can tell you that.
Hold on, let me go ahead and call you. Fuck you! I'm not gonna answer that shit. No.
Nope. We're up in Montreal. We don't do that shit. We don't answer
it's
calls.
It's too cold to answer calls in Montreal.
We don't answer the phone, bitch. That shit's cold on your skin.
You have something to say? You send a rider on a horse.
You gotta hold that up to your face and it burns. It burns in Montreal. It burns. That shit burns.
He's busy. Well, to be fair, John, call failed.
That's
not a good sign.
He's just teasing us. maybe it's somebody who broke into Guillaume's apartment and actually just saw
broke
Skype,
into Guillaume's
saw
apartment
Skype open.
With the generator.
Yeah, exactly.
Started up the generator so he could get on Skype as Guillaume.
Yep.
Just to ruin the episode.
It's gone all Fallout and like, you know,
obviously
Borderlands up there.
This was the plan. The plan was very elaborate, to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
Also, loving this new look Capitals, John. No wins. Bunch of stupid losses.
Well, at least they're predictable.
Bring back the lockout.
At least,
let's do it.
Hey, at least you don't have to worry about them choking in the playoffs again.
Shut the fuck up. Yep, you know all about teams choking in the playoffs.
Hey, man.
Call me John.
Believe me, I do, brother. Across the board. We're still just talking about hockey, right?
Yeah. That's true. Well,
And we're talking. Or do you mean baseball? Or do you mean football? Believe me, I got them all, man. I got them all.
I went to get groceries because I'm like, well, it's over now. Fuck me.
No.
What
I mean,
just happened?
Oh no! Like as soon as they went up like 17 zip or whatever like that, Amy and I were sitting here and we're just like, it's not even over. It's not even close to over. You know?
I saw that. I'm like, I don't even think Matt Ryan could screw this up.
Oh no! It's this. I mean, the thing is, they did that all year. They did that like in three or four games this year where they went out to a big lead and they just let the other team get back into it. And then at the very end, Matt Ryan did some heroics and they kicked like a 55-yard field goal to win it. They did that like three or four times.
Oh.
Guillaume, pick up the phone.
Oh, fail.
Guillaume, pick up the phone.
Guillaume's like, guys, it's really cold. Give me some time here.
Never met a guy that I couldn't forget except Guy Fajet.
Guillaume Viet. You kidding?
Nice. Oh, God. I'm looking. So, I mean, we lost to the relocated Thrashers, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the fucking... I mean, they're called the Jets for some god-awful reason that I can't figure out.
What, the Winnipeg Jets?
Yeah.
Yeah, because the Winnipeg Jets... The Winnipeg team used to be called the Jets.
I know, but I still don't know why.
I don't know. I don't know why they were originally called the Jets.
They're based on a New York street gang. Likes to sing a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. When did they come into the league?
The Sharks.
There are the Sharks. The John's team.
Yep. How is there not an NFL team named the Sharks?
There I don't know. Why aren't the Sharks known as the Street Sharks? It'd be much better. Much better.
That sounds like something.
The Sewer Sharks.
Or the Game Sharks. That'd be great.
Tell me right now, you would be surprised in the slightest if Gary Bettman approved changing the name to the Street Sharks.
He would because but the thing is, you have to think like Bettman though. He would be like,
I can't
okay.
think like Bettman. I haven't used enough drugs.
Bettman would say, well, we have to appeal to the urban culture.
So therefore,
putting
the
word street in the name of one of our teams is going to be a sure shot. And you have to change their colors to black and silver. That's also
all teams black and silver.
That's also the big thing. Yep.
All of them. Every team. Black and silver. Do it.
Yep.
Also, the season will be played in the summer. Outdoors. You know, the outdoor game has been a lot of success for us lately. Let's move all games outdoors.
Yep.
Tampa Bay, you're on notice.
From now on, in the summer, roller hockey. The summer classic. Roller hockey.
Tell me you wouldn't pay any amount of money to see Ovechkin on rollerblades playing roller hockey.
No budget.